What's up, everyone? Welcome to the Smoking Tire Podcast. This episode of the Smoking Tire Podcast is brought to you by StockX. StockX is the world's first online stock market of things for high-demand consumer products, including sneakers, watches, and handbags. StockX connects buyers and sellers using the same methodology as the world's stock markets, an anonymous live bid-ask market. All products are physically authenticated by StockX, allowing participants to focus on the transparency of data available, including real-time market pricing. That means no stressing about shady buyers and sellers, and no blurry pictures to decipher. All watches are in excellent or better condition. All you have to worry about is finding the watch you want and placing a bid you feel comfortable with. I'm happy to announce I partnered up with StockX to give away an Autodromo Group B Evoluzione watch starting today, Tuesday the 11th, through Tuesday, September 18th. Check out my Instagram from today for details on how to enter. The Smoking Tire on Instagram. Check it out for how to enter in the contest. The winner will be announced next week on my Instagram. That's September 18th. Again, I'm giving away an Autodromo Group B Evoluzione watch on my Instagram. Hit it up at the Smoking Tire. You'll see the watch. You will see how to enter. Thank you very much, Autodromo and StockX. That's sweet. We are also brought to you today by Beeline Coffee. The roasted tire is in stock now. That's the Smoking Tire, my personal roast. It's so delicious. It's literally the best coffee I've ever tasted, and it was made just for me. And I love coffee. I'm a coffee nerd. You guys are going to like it too. I give it to everyone I possibly can. Go to BeelineCoffee.com and use code TST to get 15% off anything in the Beeline Coffee store. On this episode of the podcast, we've got Paul Gerard in studio. This dude rules. He was the U.S. Stig for Top Gear, and he's a racing driver, a instructor, a motivational speaker, an inspiration to a lot of people who really just want to be involved in motorsport. He did it from the ground up, and it's badass. And he's got a new book out. He's here to talk about it. It's Paul Gerard on the Smoking Tire Podcast.
Our podcast. This is now the show. Hi. What's happening, folks? It's Tuesday. It's the end of a long weekend. And I, myself, am on day one of a month without weed. So I apologize for where this show's going to go
in advance. You're going to be in a great mood.
You know, sometimes I'm good when I'm angry. Other times, not so much. We're going to find out which it is today. Paul Gerard is in studio. What's up, brother?
Hey, not too much. And I'm from Colorado.
The other legal state. Yeah, there's many of us now.
Yeah, there are quite a few. But
you don't smoke weed. Racing drivers don't smoke weed.
I don't do nothing.
No?
No.
No booze, no nothing?
Nothing.
Well, you're very fit, so that probably goes to that.
I'm out running on the beach the last couple of days.
Are you?
Me. Yeah.
Yeah.
Trying.
I walk on sand. I have, like, do you see my tape? I have this tape on my knees. I had two, one on each knee, a torn patellar tendon. And it's not so bad as long as I got the tape going on. And I got like this rock tape shit on my knees. But one of the things I do, I go on like really long walks on the beach to like strengthen up my feet muscles, which I guess help with that shit. Good for your arches.
There you go. I saw it in your profile. And then walks on the beach.
Walks on the beach. Yeah.
Get himself in the mood.
You know what? If I put the actual things I did in my life, it would probably sound like that shit. Like cooking and red wine and walks on the beach and long hikes and soft music. It would actually be too lame to be believable, but it's real.
It's perfect 90s dating profile.
Yeah, it's fucking brutal. Anyway, welcome to the show, everybody. We chilling today. Paul is a world-renowned racing driver, a driving instructor, a celebrity, a television driver, a video journalist. What else do you do? A lot of other things.
A lot of coaching, teaching, presentations,
large-scale coaching.
No, very one-on-one, actually. I mean, I did do large-scale. I was the chief instructor of special projects for Skip Barber for many years. And
what
I
is
also,
a Skip Barber special project? I'm just wondering.
It's everything manufacturer-based, which was a big part of their business.
So they would, like, farm out their staff for a press launch or something to that effect?
Yeah, press launches, ride and drives, all that kind of stuff. Uh-huh. And then I was the director of training for the Jim Russell Racing Driver School. So I did all of everything, wrote all the curriculums, did all of that stuff. So I've done my fair share of a very large scale coaching, and then worked my way down to these days, really more doing just one-on-one stuff.
One-on-one. Mm-hmm. Are you riding right seat or are you all data at this point?
I'll do any of it.
Will you ride
right
seat?
I'm not one of those guys. Yeah, and I'll tell you why, and I'm pretty passionate about that too, is I don't ride right seat with anybody.
Oh,
I need
choose.
To know them,
yeah, yeah.
And I trust them, and I've built a reputation, you know, there's mutual respect, there's all those things, and that makes right seating okay, because they're not going to do anything silly.
I
don't randomly, and I would never recommend anyone randomly just jump in someone's car they don't know going right seat. That's a recipe for disaster.
Do you vet a student before you take them on as a student, and therefore you'll trust them to ride right seat, or if it's a new student?
Or do you just start with the data?
Yeah. No. I with my coaching, one of the things that I always do is I take them to zero. I don't ever assume they know anything, even though they may be very talented drivers.
And that must go well with very talented drivers.
It's funny, actually, but
especially
it's
Russians.
It's part of the thing where there's just too much. There's too many gaps in people's learning these days because they tend to learn in such a random variety of ways from track days and things like that that don't teach real fundamentals. And whenever I've ever gone and coached with anyone, I've always found fundamentals that are missing. We end up having to go back and play anyway.
Yeah.
So I just start there. And
it's like hand position or seat position.
Skid pad.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, can you maintain a slide around
not
the
even,
skid pad?
No, not even that. Can you recognize understeer?
Oh.
How good are you at recognizing understeer? That's actually a huge key component in a good driver. You're going to spend your whole career recognizing understeer and oversteer, and the guys that are really good at it don't let the car slide. They actually start fixing it before the understeer develops. They were already rebalancing, and that's fast guys do that. People that let the car understeer and then count to two in their heads and then fix it, which is normal, you know, that kind of stuff. It's like, you need to get on a skid pad and you need to really get to the point where, and it's not just a skid pad. I also dial it up, but it's basically not, everyone thinks of skid pads these days as going out and just doing oversteer and having fun, but
it can
it's
be
slide
that.
Recognition. You get the fun after I see the slide recognition. Like you have it ingrained that you can catch it. And you do it really quick and you do it without thinking about it.
Right, so it's recognition and then faster recognition to muscle memory.
Well, then it transitions into anticipation, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's reaction, there's really fast reaction, then there's anticipation. And so we're trying to get people so that they can actually anticipate the slide. And you got a plan, you know?
Yeah.
You're like, I'm going to take it up there, I'm going to do this. And again, it's not like you're thinking through it. It's like it's an ingrained response in your body. You don't even think about it. And I even, you know, talk about it in my book. I said one thing that I often do is I actually will chat with you. I'll ask you really dumb questions about the weather or whatever while the car is starting to slide. I need to see conversation there to know that it's actually ingrained in you.
You need to send the brain somewhere else to know that it's not the brain controlling the body right now.
Yeah, it's
conscious versus subconscious.
Yeah. It can't be conscious because consciously you can only do one thing at a time.
Right.
So
and if you're in a race,
car,
you're looking at the
multiples.
Rest of the cars on the track and your placement and whatever.
Bingo.
And you should not be thinking about oversteer and understeer.
That's right. Yeah, it needs to be all ingrained and subconscious. Yeah. And so those are kind of like your foundation, your pillars of driving, as it were, however you want to put it. But it's that kind of stuff. And so if you do that with someone and you spend a day or two with someone like that, then go out on the racetrack with them, it's no big deal to ride right seat with them because you know they have the foundational stuff.
Yeah.
It's the folks that you assume have the foundational stuff that get you in trouble. They're trying to impress you. They don't know how to catch a slide, and they're trying to impress you. That doesn't sound like a great day
anybody. If they know how to get into a slide and not catch it, that'd be very scary.
Yeah, and it's, again, the recognition. Like, you're just like, are you going to do anything about this? And nothing yet. I reach over, grab the wheel, you know, or whatever. And there's, you know, thousands of driving instructors that have been through that very scenario many times.
I hate the wheel grabbing.
Yeah.
I don't like the wheel grabbing as a strategy.
Exactly. It's
don't
very
do that
last ditch.
I'm literally going to kill you.
It's last ditch.
If I'm
going to
kill you, grab the wheel. I had a very good teacher recently, someone who is genuinely world-renowned. You know his name.
Right.
I'm not going to blow up his spot right here, but he was a wheel grabber. And I was like, I like this person. This is a nice person. I want to hang out at the bar with this guy, but I don't want him to teach. Wheel grabbing to me really needs to be either a life-saving thing.
That's what I
in which case knock yourself out.
Yeah.
He wasn't doing it. He was wheel grabbing to make minor positioning corrections, which to me didn't stick in my brain. It went in one and
it's
out
not the
other.
Right place for that.
Yeah, you know, if you said, a little further to the right here, a little further to the left, I would have probably memorize it better, but
right.
I sympathize with someone who feels like they're about to die.
Absolutely. Even though you may not agree, they might.
No, yeah. I wasn't going to kill this person. Right. I was just I could have used a little more curbing on the exit.
Yeah.
And when he's grabbing the wheel and pushing you towards the exit and the wall, you're, dude, I'm working my way up to that.
Again, a lot of that is all kind of symptomatic training, which is one of the real things that I don't like. I like the going for the root cause, and like I'll never tell someone break later. Or eyes up or anything like that, because those are all symptoms of what the real problem is. And until you fix that, putting a Band-Aid on it by getting him to look up is not a good idea. It's like you got to figure out why. You know,
I
the
tell
why
myself
behind
eyes
it.
Up a lot. When I'm in the car, that's my mantra to myself is eyes
it
up.
It doesn't really work, though, because all it is when you're sort of your subconscious all clicks in, your eyes go boop, and they're up. They're up. But when you're trying to force it, you can't make it happen. Not for any length of time. Like, you can do it for an instant, but your eyes will drop right back down. And then you ask yourself, you have to ask yourself again, why? And why is, like, everything isn't clicking at that moment. And the thing that I use for, you hear, like, the phrase, the zone or flow, right? That's what it is. So you're trying to get into flow. When you flow, your eyes just look. And it's amazing. Like, you don't... Trying to make yourself do something correct is not a good way to teach. You got to figure out why you're just not doing it right.
For me, it happens. I mean, look, again, this is just me. Who the fuck knows what else for anyone out there? Why their eyes might go down or whatever. For me, if I'm racing, if I haven't done it in a while, or if I'm drifting and I haven't done it in a while, especially drifting.
Yeah.
Drifting is when I really do the eyes up thing, because drifting, it's really easy to let your eyes wander from where they're supposed to be if you're not fucking Chris Forsberg. You know, so that's where I typically use it. Or if I haven't been in a race car in a while, I got to kind of get myself back in that
zone.
That's
super normal. I'm the same way. If I haven't been in a car, my eyes aren't looking down the road, but I'm saying telling yourself to look down the road is not the solution. It's just actually getting comfortable, and then the eyes will come up by themselves.
It's an
interesting kind of, you know, chicken or the egg conversation, isn't it?
Did you have good teachers?
I did. I've had some really amazing teachers, actually. I was
anybody
very,
still
very
around?
Lucky. Bruce Reichel, who's taught me. I've done so much weird stuff over time, but. Like he taught me how to drive a sedan really well, and that was doing all the security stuff for State Department anti-terrorist.
Oh, have you done that shit?
Tons of it.
Fun.
But not in a while, but I used to do a lot of it when I lived in Virginia like 25 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And he was really good. He taught me how to drive a sedan really well. I was a formula car guy.
Like a Vic?
Yeah, Crown Vic. Absolutely, yeah.
Former Crown Vic owner right here, Zach Kleppman.
Absolutely.
There you go. And you know, set up right, those things can be quite good. And
I've heard.
Never experienced it, but no. Yeah, they used to do performance friction brake pads and kind of all the little, they had all these little tweaks. It was the Bill Scott Racing School, which is at Summit Point, West Virginia. It was there forever.
Well, those the Bondurant Cobra Vics were the ones, right?
Yeah.
One of those sold a year or two ago at Barrett for like $40,000.
That's amazing.
Seriously,
yeah,
isn't that crazy? An ex school car,
yeah,
fucking
I know.
Kidding me?
Low miles,
probably smells like. Oh, I don't even
who
want
knows
to know.
Manual transmission.
Yeah, it's got like 4,000 miles on it, and all of them were in red line.
Exactly,
eight clutches.
Oh, sure, absolutely.
So, okay, so your teachers, who did you have that was still around?
So Bruce Reichel, and Bruce is retired, but he taught at that school for 20, 30 years. I actually learned a lot there. They did gun training and everything. I went through all of that as well.
Uh-huh.
And I learned the difference between, you know, sort of facilitating and actually teaching when I was watching those gun classes.
Okay.
Like, that was stuff done at next level over any of the driver training I'd ever seen before. Just how they sort of commanded respect and went through
things. They're holding guns.
Yeah, exactly. It does. I mean,
it does,
it's sort
that.
Of the environment, right? it sort of necessitates that you take it seriously. But it's a step beyond driving a car. You see what I mean? So because of that, there was a step beyond in the way they were teaching it. And I actually, like, I was like, that's interesting. That would be cool to apply that to teaching in cars. And again, it's sort of that philosophy of not trying to be symptomatic when you try and, you know, show someone something, but figure out why behind everything, and then you rebuild them basically step by step with them understanding the why behind each piece of the puzzle. Then you have someone that can actually flow or be in the zone under pressure in the moment. That's a great driver.
Yeah.
And they're so rare, right? I mean, they're so rare. And I've got to coach but really good people.
It can be taught.
It's all taught. And I don't believe in natural talent, actually.
No?
Not at all.
You never seen someone who has sort of just absorbed? I mean, not that they have all everything, but you don't think that some people are inherently just better suited to this task than others?
Well, I don't think so. I think we all are unique individuals, and we all have our own path. And we all have the potential to follow that path all the way to greatness in anything we really want to do, right? But we have to have that determination. Now, is it easier for some people? Heck yeah.
Yeah.
Right? But there's also problems with it being easy. Like some people that are not risk averse, for instance, right? So again, they're folks that don't get scared, and they tend to crash a lot.
But it never really bothers them.
No, but they run out of money, or they get hurt.
Cars.
Yeah, they they have like the fast, like they get the attention right away. Mm-hmm. But then there's the people that are methodical. Why are they methodical? Because it scares them, and so they have to sort of get rid of the fear step by step.
So you approach driving as the science and not as the extreme sport, and then
both of those types end up winning world championships. I'm saying anyone can do it. It's sort of the determination to see it through. It's the curiosity to wonder how good you can be. That's the spark of genius within anyone, within any topic, right? Like, it's that curiosity that will push them further. Other people give up. Most people give up a good, and they're happy. Think of everyone that runs around at a track day.
Yeah.
Perfectly happy. I need to do is beat my circle of friends. I'm awesome.
Right.
They all say I'm awesome, and I'm awesome. And they're 5-6 seconds off the pace of what, you know, a good driver or a really good driver, let alone a great driver, would actually do around that track in that car that day. But they're happy, and they stop at that point. They plateau. Think of skiers, you know. You can think of anything like that. You know, people that spend their lives on a blue trail skiing don't ever go to the black or the double black extreme stuff. They're like, I'm happy on the blue trails. That's most track day people, you know. So it's that internal drive, and it comes from that curiosity, like, how good could I be?
See, the thing is, to defend those people, to go from that casual track day, I'm quicker than my friends. It feels like I'm going fast. I'm driving clean. I haven't had a crash in 10 years. To go from that to I'm a contender in a semi-professional racing series, or I have learned that I am and can be that good with this much work. It's a lot of time and money to go from good to great.
It doesn't have to be money.
It?
If you're doing track
money.
Days, buying your, you know, if you're buying faster and faster cars and doing that, but
I mean, it's not like it takes a basketball and a fucking a playground.
No, that's
you know
true.
What I'm saying? It's a lot of time and money.
Karting, for instance.
True.
Like all I want's a shifter kart, man. Put me in a shifter kart or a 125 direct drive. Or
true.
Like that's everything you ever need to learn about driving right there, other than aerodynamics.
I just called Jim Hall's karting school today, like an hour ago, because I realized
brilliant.
That karting is a huge hole in my driving. So kind of like you said, I think natural talent is like there are people that are hand-eye coordinated and there are people who aren't. And then from there, it seems like anyone who has natural talent may have just had a lot of pieces add up in their childhood or adolescence.
That's it.
And driven a lot. Like we used to go,
my dad got me a go-kart. I started driving
natural
young.
Natural talent.
I think that's
quote unquote
seen as natural
is what,
talent.
Is nurturing from young
it's
natural
just,
talent?
Yeah, it's just like if I don't know someone's history and they look young and I've never seen them drive a race car and they're fast in that race car, I'm like, wow, what a naturally talented kid. I don't know the backstory.
Yeah.
They were playing on bicycles, skateboards, skiing, doing all those things as kids, karting background, whatever it is. It doesn't matter. Running through the trees in the woods, you know, that will give you a feel for it. It all matters, right?
Yeah.
And so to me, talent is actually rate of learning. Like you, and that's more like you're talking about intelligence. Some people can learn things really fast.
True.
I'm not a super fast learner, but I'm very determined. Right?
Mm-hmm.
At the end, we get to the same place. One can do it faster. The person that does it that has the perseverance typically is tougher. It's like the kid that gets beat up. They end up being tough at the end of it all. Like you feel sorry for them, but now they're scrappy and they don't take anything from anyone anymore. That can be a race car driver as well.
Yeah.
The people that just got in the car, went fast, daddy, mommy's money, all that stuff. They don't really, really, really want to be there necessarily. They're just there because it's cool.
Yeah.
But the person that worked every single day and none of it was easy and they didn't have the money and they didn't have the budget, And all they had to think about not wrecking the car, because they didn't get to run it the next day if they did, because they didn't have the money to put it back together. Those people end up being amazing, but they have to have that crazy level of determination to see that all through.
Well, it's hard to, because you've got the determination. Still, money is a thing, right? You know, you have to drive the car at its limit, but you can't crash it.
Yeah.
You can't break
right,
it.
Yeah.
You know, that's a hard place to be.
Yeah.
You know,
that's what it's exactly all about.
Because
though.
To be successful, you can't just have a car that you don't crash and don't break. You also have to have a competitive car
that
you don't crash and don't break.
Yeah.
And you have to know how to set that car up, or at least tell someone how to set that car up.
Yeah.
It's a lot to it.
It's an amazing puzzle, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's really cool. And that's what's fun about it is, you know, and why I sort of set out to write a book about it, because all the driving books were like the mechanics of driving.
Which we haven't plugged yet.
Here you go. Take that.
The book is called, hold it up to that camera. The book is called Optimum Drive. And that's what you're here to talk about. We have not plugged it yet. What's the book about?
So it was born out of frustration, because I've read every book, and there's some really good books out there. And
driving books?
Yeah.
Speed Secrets? Are you a Speed Secrets
not
fan?
Not huge. Okay. I like Going Faster. I like Drive
to
Win.
Who wrote Going Faster?
Going Faster is a Skip Barber book.
Oh, okay.
And I didn't have anything to do with it, though I knew a lot of the people that are in it. Carl Lopez wrote it with a lot of very good interviews that he
did. Bruce McInnes is my guy from Skip Barber.
Yeah.
He taught me to drive in 2005.
I think everyone on the planet that's ever been on a track knows Bruce McInnes.
Bruce McInnes is one of the bossest OG instructors.
Absolutely.
How fucking old is he now?
In
his 70s.
And he almost died a few years ago. He had a he had some really serious health issues that he's bounced back from.
Oh, good for
And now
Bruce.
He's with the new Skip Barber, quote unquote, that's down at, where is it, in Millville?
Yeah, they're running
New
Mustangs.
Jersey Motorsports Park.
Yeah, they got Mustangs going. Charlie Bruth just ran out that course. But Bruce was like, when I saw him wheel that van, the first 15-passenger van ride around Lime Rock, you know.
Infamous.
And
down the downhill.
And he took a call during it, and he's one-handed fucking drifting the van in the rain.
Yeah.
I was like, I got to be this guy. This guy gets all of it.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, Bruce is awesome.
Yeah.
And there was this amazing fraternity at Skip Barber back in like the 80s and 90s, and I came in at the end of that, really, so I knew all of those guys, but I, you know, there was this whole crew that was there. Walt Boren, who's passed on now, and we were talking about catamarans. He had a catamaran down at the BVIs, and he'd retired down there and unfortunately drowned down there. But there were so many amazing instructors that they had back in the day that I was lucky enough to learn from. You know, I was talking about Bruce Reigel with the other school, with the anti-terror school, but also at Skip Barber there were some great guys. Pete Argensinger, I don't know if you ever met him.
I don't think so. No.
Oh my goodness, there's so many good guys. Bruce McQuiston.
What is it with guys named Bruce?
Yeah, I don't know.
Seven.
They're
Bruces
all from Australia.
Teaching.
Bruce and Mick something.
Yes, exactly. Yes. And Shayla's. But anyway, yeah. So really, really good guys there, and so that book, Going Faster, is quite a good book. But most of the books tend to be more from the perspective of the engineer. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
They're like a lot of math in them, and a lot of geometry, and there's math equations, and race car drivers in math equations, no bueno.
What do you mean, like the 100 points of the tire kind of thing?
All sorts of stuff. Just like 15 like GR squared that we used to put up at Skip Barber on the board.
What the fuck is that? I don't even know what that is.
Radius equals mile per hour, basically.
Oh, Jesus. So, fuck that. Third gear, 4,000 RPM, you got grip.
There you go.
what are we doing math for? Drive the car.
Well, that's the point, right? So you read all these books, and they promise all these things, but they don't deliver that driving is subjective. It's a feel thing. It's all feel, every bit of it. It's not when you're looking at your data. When you're not in the car, you can make it objective, and you're looking at actual numbers, and I've got results, and here's where you're breaking, and here's where I'm breaking. But then once you're out in the car, it's back to being all feel. I mean, maybe you have a predictive lap time.
Right.
That's it. Other than that, you've got feel. Mm-hmm. And so I wrote a book from that perspective, from this is what it's supposed to feel like. It's like, what does fast feel like?
What does fast feel like?
It's a good feeling, I can tell you that.
It's hard to know. Every time I go, if I'm running timed laps, the lap I feel is the fastest does not necessarily match up to the lap that is the fastest.
You know why?
Why?
You don't know what fast feels
that
like.
That could be why. That's why I just asked you what fast feels like.
Well, it's not something you can define. It's something that you have to have the experience to know, right? So I do go through it step by step, but it starts on the skid pad. and then it goes onto your first lapping of the track. And then when you go on the track, it's finding the limits in three phases of every corner, right? It's entry, mid-corner, and exit. And you start finding the limits when you ever go on a track. I bet you guys do this. You start in the slow corners because that's mm-hmm. safe. Mm-hmm. And then when you get confidence in the slow corners, haven't spun the car, car feels good, everything's great, then you move to the medium speed corner. So you go from your second gear to your third gear corners, mm-hmm. right? And then eventually, hopefully, within a session or two, you're also exploring the balance of the car, turn in, mid corner, and exit in your fourth gear corners as well. And now you're like, okay, pretty much the whole track. And then you're moving the brake zones down, right? You always start with the hard braking and then you dial it down till it starts to connect to the turn in, and now you're able to trail brake in those slow to medium speed corners. Mm-hmm. And all so it's learning what fast is what's the tire needs to be optimized at any point. And there's, of course, four tires. So you're balancing four tires simultaneously, which not a lot of people consider. They think about the grip of the outside tire and the outside front tire or the outside rear tire. It's like, that's not the whole picture. You got four. Right now, sometimes not all of them are touching.
Yeah, I mean, if you're loading up, the inside two matter less.
Yes, but they still matter. They're still part of the balance of the car. They still provide grip, especially when you start getting into the more setup side of things. You realize if you add droop travel, for instance, you can increase the car's grip.
Because what's droop travel? I don't believe I've heard that term before. Droop is the
shock extending.
Oh,
so imagine when you're like leaning your car.
So if it's light, you could still have the tire on the ground.
And you get a little bit of grip.
That makes sense.
And if you think about those inside tires dragging around the corner, if you think about like polar moment of inertia, actually turns you. It's the mm-hmm. drag on the inside. You think of like how ESP steers a car. It doesn't do it by turning the wheel. It does it by braking.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So if you provide grip on the inside, it actually turns the car through the corner. Grip on the outside actually makes the car want to go straight.
Like, it'd be interesting if you had a corner and you wet down the inside, you know, an inside section, and then you drove around it with the outside wheels on the dry and the inside wheels on the wet, and then the next corner is 100% dry, and you could just compare the speeds, and I'm sure people would that's when you'd realize, like, the inside tires matter.
And they all matter. Now, we don't, as a driver, we don't control lateral load transfer. That's done by the suspension, right? You're just going to corner the car at the limit. So I'm not driving going, let me put some more load on my inside tires right corner. That would mean I need to straighten the wheel, which means I don't go through the turn.
So
that's more of a setup thing.
There.
Right. But the actual fore and aft, right, balance setting of the car. And then understanding, again, that the tire is the key. Like, and that's the other thing, that the book is written from the perspective that the tire is the most important component. It's not the driver, not the car, it's the tire. So optimizing the tire will make you go faster. And one of the cool things I got to do when I wrote the book is I sent it to a lot of people to vet it before I released it. I wanted to make sure it was very technically correct. And I was very lucky enough to be able to send it to Michelin Motorsports, because I have some friends there. I've worked for Michelin. I'm actually leaving tomorrow to go work for Michelin. And so Michelin went through it. And I'm like, this is so important that you guys are down with this. Mm-hmm. And I was at COTA, actually, during the WEC race, talking to the head of Michelin Motorsports. And I was describing to him the concepts of the book, and goes, I need you to go down and tell two of the top teams down there in GT right now, I'm not going to mention their names, exactly what you just told me, because if I could get them to understand what you just said you put in your book, they'd be way faster than they are right now.
Why
and they
don't
were
just
full on factory
sell them
teams.
A couple books.
I do.
They might have taken offense to it.
Yeah. Well, you got to make it seem like it's their idea. Right?
I heard you guys need these.
Yeah. First, we're going to go to the skid pad.
Yeah.
But anyway, it was really fun. So I ran it through Michelin Motorsports to make sure that everything was technically correct, because everything I was basing it upon was optimizing the tire is actually what you're trying to do with your car setup. For instance, like, people will run as much camber as they can, you know, because they can. And,
right.
But you need to run the right amount for the tire, you know, and that's really the critical thing. And so our job as a driver is to balance the car to get the most out of those tires. We're trying to turn the same lap time as everyone else with a touch less tire wear.
Right.
That's actually what winning driving is about. It's like
not taking that extra pit stop.
Yeah.
And staying out for the five extra laps.
It's not even into pit stops. It's degradation of the tire. So if I can run the same lap time as you, think of Scott Dixon being a good example of that as an IndyCar guy that's just really good at always being there at the end. And he's there at the end because he turns the same lap times as the other guys, but he does it with a tiny bit less tire wear and a little bit less fuel consumption. So even if it's not an extra pit stop, that means he needs less fuel. Yeah. So his car's lighter, right? And he's also, there's a delta with your tires from when they're new to when they're old. Of course, watch Formula One for that, right? And so what you're doing is you're able to keep the degradation from being as steep. So you're not losing as much grip over laps. So over 5 laps, you're turning the same lap times, but now in 10 laps, you're faster. In 20, you're way faster.
Is slowing down.
Tires are going. So that's actually, it's such a subtle thing, but races are won by thousandths of a second. And so that's maybe a couple of inches on a racetrack after driving 3 miles. You know, that's all down to just the most subtle, amazing stuff. And it all comes back to what? Feeling what fast is. Feeling what efficient is. And it's getting flow and having being in the zone and all those things. Why? Because all your fundamentals are just nailed down. And I love to build drivers like that. And I truly believe anyone can be like that. But they just have to have that dogged determination and also be very, very reality based. A lot of people are very irrational with how they look at their driving, and you know, they make assumptions about limits and car setups and all those things, and all those will ever do is eventually they'll plateau you. You're done.
Yeah.
You're done. You won't get any better. You've got to always have that open mind and be willing to try new things and be very rational, very honest with yourself, which is not easy.
What's this like? All right, so you've got your guys who go to track days and they're in the advanced group and they're the fastest guy in one of the fastest guys in their track day, but they stay there. And then you've got guys who go on to have careers. What happens in the middle? In between these two?
In the middle, well, there's a whole component of racecraft that is a whole different skill set. So the ability to fight for victory with other good drivers, right? That's not easy. And so you can have people that are brilliant qualifiers, as the example, and not good racers, right? So they're very fast, technically proficient driving the car, but when you go head-to-head on the last lap, they always come out second. You know, in the confrontation.
That's me. I don't like, I mean, honestly, that's me. I do endurance racing and not like real endurance racing. Like I race AER, it's like bullshit racing.
Right.
But it's fun. Yeah. I enjoy it. I'm practicing and improving, whatever. I take starts because I keep it clean. You know, I'll run a 90 minute session nice and clean and I'll race people. But like, you know, I don't have the last corner thing. I don't have it. Maybe it's because I always like had to fix the car. I know I don't have it.
Yeah, because I'll know I'll pass that guy, right? So it's like,
if you were racing me, you'd probably beat me.
You can be taught to have that. That one's tough. It takes time and it takes confidence. And you have to really, really want it. But there's something interesting that clicks in certain people where nothing matters at that point. Like you don't think about, I have a family, I have children, I have responsibilities. It's like, I need to pass this guy.
Yeah, shit matters to me. I can't throw the things that matter out the window.
I can make it not matter.
I'm sure. No, I mean, just to me, there's nothing to me personally that is worth smashing this car into that wall for in this fun race.
It's knowing you can do it without smashing it.
Maybe.
Right?
Maybe.
And,
but I don't know that I can.
Exactly.
I might be able to. I might also fucking hit the wall.
That's the thing that can be taught, though. That can be
probably
taught. Yeah.
Well, if it's something you don't encounter a lot, like you know, for me, my hiccup or some of my holes are really fast cornering because I just don't get exposed to lots of big track driving. So, like you were saying before, you know, everyone, you kind of figure out the track and the car on like a 2-3 gear corner, and then 4 and 5, you know, that's a different story. So if I'm coming out towards a wall and it's 130 miles an hour, like I don't do it a lot, and so that is something that makes me nervous. And if you aren't dicing with cars at the end of a race a lot, then it's like a foreign situation and you start to get stressed and cortisone and all these other things start happening and you're just like, I'm just not used to this.
Yeah. So I mean, there's real fears in racing. I mean, there's real risks. So there's things to really be afraid of. But what you just described, almost all of it's irrational. And here's the thing about that you have to consider. How long have you known that you don't like going through fast corners?
I think it's not that I don't like it. It's that I don't do it enough where I'm comfortable doing it.
So how long have you known that?
I don't know, since 2010. When did we start? When did we meet and start driving fast?
So, 2009.
So next thing I'm going to ask you is really obvious. So why haven't you done anything about it?
I haven't had the money to do track days till very recently. So that's why I'm signing up for schools.
Yeah. So schools are cool, but again, remember the karting options. There's a lot of cheaper options to go and do things, but Here's another point, right? We tend to categorize ourselves as having strengths and weaknesses. Okay, you guys with me on that, right?
Mm-hmm.
We stick with that stuff. That plateaus you.
what you should do, like our happy place is to kind of do the things that we're good at. Like instead of worrying about that fourth gear corner, I'm just going to enjoy the second and third gear corners because I'm really good at them. And I'm going to have a great session. The more I think about trying to do well in those fourth gear corners, the less I'm going to enjoy today kind of mentality. And that's the opposite of the determination you need to become great at something.
Oh, I totally agree.
So it has to be, I am not going to even think about the second and third gear corners this time out. All I am going to do is that corners drive me nuts. That 1/4, that 1/5 gear corner, whatever it is, that high speed transition where the car might spin. It's like attack your weaknesses.
Call it 8 and 9 at Willow Springs.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, right. Willow's good. Or how about Sonoma? Right,
Sonoma. At least you know what. At least Sonoma's pretty.
It's pretty. When you're spinning around,
Willow Springs is grimy. Maybe it's because of TV, but
no. I feel like if you go off at Sonoma, I never have, but there's grass.
Things.
Like, do you hit?
No, you hit
things?
Walls.
Oh, you,
no,
hit,
you hit walls.
Yeah. That's an expensive place to go.
Yeah. Okay,
because it's got a lot of fast corners and not a lot of runoff.
You know what the most interesting place to be is if you want to watch crashes? Road Atlanta of a Friday race weekend. Fuck, I was just down there, and by Saturday and Sunday, the fear sets into people.
Right.
But Friday, everyone thinks they're Lewis Hamilton, and it's like, Viper, wall. Corvette, wall. GTR, wall.
I was watching the posts on Facebook as they came at me quicker than I could keep up with them of the crashes at turn 12.
Yeah.
Right. Everyone was just going off, and, you know, there were just these multiple cars. Yeah.
It's a gnarly corner.
Right?
Yeah, it was a gnarly corner. Yeah. It ended up, they calmed everybody down, and there were basically no incidents on Saturday or Sunday, but Friday was a shit show.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a disaster of crashes. Unbelievable.
Yeah, it's crazy. And it's a very expensive place to go off because there isn't much runoff there, right?
I mean, either 12 or 1.
Yeah.
If you go down 12, which is the big downhill onto the front straight, if you fuck it up on the exit, you basically ping pong down the straight.
Yeah. And get collected, probably, by anyone coming down the hill.
You fucking yard sale all over the track. Well, that's what happened. This Corvette, did you see the Corvette picture?
Yeah,
it was the most amazing picture of a Corvette in the air, sideways, yard sailing all over the track with the fucking hatch flown open. Just Google like GridLife Corvette crash Road Atlanta. I don't want to draw attention to the fact that people did crash at GridLife, but
people crash every weekend.
People crash all the time, and the picture was so incredible that if you can find it, it's worth seeing. But that Corvette crash, and then he collected two other cars.
Yeah.
And that was a problem.
It is, and again, all these things are people in with fast cars, and again, I don't know those guys as drivers. Maybe they're amazing and had mechanical failures or whatever. But
the Viper,
yeah,
it was on paper tags. He'd owned it for 2 days.
Oh, poor guy. Well, he fit
it's
in
me.
He fit the stereotype of the Viper, which is that's the most crashed car.
You know,
usually within the first
had,
10 miles or something like that, right?
Have you had much seat time in Vipers?
Tons. Yeah.
I love Vipers. I think they're fun.
I do too. The mm-hmm. thing about Vipers to me is they don't have feel. They have a lot of grip and they're really fast. They're experienced cars. So if you think of like a Porsche or a Ferrari or whatever, there's a ton of feel, which means there's lots of I'm getting near the limit. You might want to think about backing off. The Viper just
good
has
point.
grip, snap.
Yeah.
And you have to learn where that is. And it has very numb steering that's relatively quick. The car's very stiff and low. And, of course, it has a super grippy, you know, massive tires on it.
Yeah.
So that means when it lets go quite suddenly without much warning. And so that's a car. I remember I drove the original RT10 giving drift demo laps at the Philadelphia Grand Prix.
Jesus.
On this road course through Fairmont
Every
Park
single
there.
Word in that fucking statement is old as fuck, dude.
Yeah.
Let's break it down. Philadelphia Grand Prix.
When was
Viper
that?
RT10.
Yeah. And I raced Mario Andretti. That's even better. He was the Grand Marshal, and he and
Bro,
I did this race there.
You
so
look
much
great
fun.
For a thousand.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Thank you. I'll take
Wait,
that.
Philadelphia Grand Prix.
Yeah.
Where the fuck was
that? It
was
a vintage race in Fairmont Park. It's like the largest.
In Fairmont Park?
Yeah.
I went to school in Philly. That's why
the
I'm
most
the
amazing
roads in Philly
track.
Are the. Really?
Oh, man. Here's
I walked
a,
through
here's
Fairmont
a quick,
Park.
Funny story about that. We were there on Friday. It was media day. They mm-hmm. didn't close the roads. I'm in the Viper, and they're chucking people in for me to give hot laps.
With open roads?
Open roads. Police full blessing.
I love when the cops
and
just,
I'm just
all
going,
of a sudden don't give a fuck.
Just going in and out of traffic.
Was it in an airfield? I found a post right before died.
No, it was. It was not. It was in Fairmont Park, downtown.
Yeah,
downtown.
Fairmont Park is legit. It's a park in the city, and it's just got like cycling roads through it.
You know, Frank Kerbeck.
Kerbeck Corvette. That's so where my Corvette came from.
He's the guy
from.
That paid me to come out and run the pace car. So it's myself and another buddy of mine, Chip Panko, and we went out and we drove like idiots for 3 days in Viper RT10s when they were brand new. Like,
that's
none
hilarious.
Of them were out. So much fun.
Frank Kerbeck got $48,000 of my dollars in 1998 for a brand new fucking Torture Red C5 Corvette.
Nice.
Yes, he
Is
did.
That the one you still have? Or?
I sold it 2 years ago to Jack Baruth.
Okay.
And his lovely wife, technically sold to Charlie, his wife. She got it as an HPDE car. She wanted to learn racecraft. After a couple track days, I think she decided it was a little too much power for her, and she sold it and got an NC Miata from the Skippy auction.
Oh, there we go.
she got an NC.
The gift that keeps on giving.
Dude, they got 40 tires. The gift they really got was 40 MX5 cup tires for, I think, $2,000. Mm. It was like 5 seasons of
race.
That's
worth the car.
Awesome. Yeah. Totally. It was worth. Yeah.
I bought these tires and they threw in a Miata.
Yes,
they did.
So, I forget what we were talking about before that. But, my Corvette. I sold it to them and they Jack traded it to somebody for a World Challenge Accord. Straight up. And he just went and he finished fifth at Mid Ohio, I think. Or it might have been at the Glen, but wherever World Challenge just was.
Right. Yeah.
He just finished in that Accord, and that guy just sold my vet on Bring a Trailer and it got like $22,000 or something.
Oh well.
Good car.
There you go.
Good car. I recommend C5s for track day folks all the time.
But yeah. Yeah, they're fun. They're kind of, again, more feel than a Viper for sure. A little, not quite.
That's
as,
how
not quite as snappy.
Viper.
Yeah,
Vipers are hairy. I mean, they are hairy cars, but they don't instinctively want you dead. You have to fuck up somewhere.
You have to do it. But they run against the grain a little bit because one of the big problems with that car, I think, is it'll bust the tires loose at like 2,500 RPM.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
You know, you're like, I'm being conservative. I'm going to come out of this corner two gears higher than I
need
to.
Right,
I can roll in. There's no way. And bam, you're in the wall.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, on a Viper, it'll break the tires loose.
It's a big fucking motor.
Yeah.
Kind of thing.
I drove the ACR, the very last version that they had, and I'm really good friends
with the newer one, the big wings,
the
and
brand
shit.
New
yeah.
one. Yeah, the very last time I drove as the Stig at Top Gear, we drove a thermal, and that
is
car
not
was
a very big track for that.
Yeah,
thermal is a lovely
it
place, but it's very small. 300 horsepower is a good number for thermal.
Yeah.
And ACR is so much car there.
it was good fun. It was good fun. I was trying to bicycle it up on the wheels.
What was that gig like? Did you enjoy it?
I did. 8 years, and it started with the NBC pilot that never aired with Adam Carolla.
Yeah. Wow. I'm still bitter about that one.
You know, here's the funny thing. I put in to do hosting on every version of it, too. Never made it. I got the top six one time, and that was as high as I ever got. You know, I got a call back, and that's it. But I ended up doing the Stig gig, which was great. I mean, that was really fun. I had to beat out a lot of drivers to get it, and so it was a really cool thing to
Did
have.
Did you literally just have to race them? Was
no,
that it?
It's actually very strange how it all happened. So it was at El Toro, again, 2008, and Tanner was the sort of the lead guy. Tanner Faust was the lead on it, and he set up a course out there, and it was this convoluted course with like six cones, but it was 4 miles long. You know, so it's like you couldn't see, like, you know, it's like, oh, and you make a left there, and he came and grabbed me, and everyone got like an hour to kind of do their thing, right? So there was only one driver there at a time, and they ran it for like 3 or 4 days. They did this driver search.
So what, you'd run the course, you'd drift, it was just a lap time.
He took you around in a, I believe it was a Mazda Speed 3. He scared the hell out of me because he did just slide it everywhere. And I'm trying to focus, and I know Tanner really, really well. So we've known each other
Battle
forever.
Of the Supercars?
Oh, I've known
Supercars. What was the other one, Supercars Exposed?
I've known him since he was a kid at the Winter Driving School.
How many shows have you hosted with him that have the word Supercars in it? Several?
So yeah, I've known him a long, long time, and we did the truck jump together for Hot Wheels.
Yeah,
like we did all that together.
Yeah.
Whoa! So
he
all
was
that.
In here talking about the science of the loop
the
and
loop.
Shit. Yeah, craziness.
Yeah,
52.5 miles an hour.
Well, the truck,
not 53.
The truck jump was the same thing. We had to leave at 106 to 107 miles an hour, and we had to be at 60% throttle. There was nothing that told you you were at 60% throttle. Talk about
feel.
It was feel.
Guess what 60% throttle is?
Yeah, you could feel it, right? You knew.
Well, you wore a thicker pair of socks on race day instead of practice day, you know.
Yeah. we were careful not to do that.
Yeah.
But jeez. Yeah, so it's the same kind of thing. So there's a lot of feel involved into doing those as well. But back to the Top Gear thing. So he gave me that one lap around, and then you jump in a Mustang and you do a lap, and then you jump in an Aston Martin, you do a lap. That mm-hmm. was it. Two laps. Right? No do-overs, no nothing. Mm-hmm. I got in the Mustang. I'm like, I don't know where the course goes. And I go out, and I got kind of lost, but not really lost. And then came back in, and I'm like, how was that? And he was like, this is all right. You know, I'm like, uh-oh. So I got in the Aston Martin, and for some reason, I remembered it, like, fine. And I drove a really good lap in the Aston Martin. It felt solid to me. And so then I said, how was that? And he was like, yeah, it was better, but didn't want to give any results. 2 weeks later, I get a call. And it's a conference call, and they're like, we want to offer you the job. You're 1.7 seconds quicker than anyone in the Aston Martin. Now, here's the funny thing. Like, 1.7 seconds, like a huge...
It's a lot.
It's yeah, huge. Like, I expect to be like 1/10 or 2/10 or 3/10. I just got less lost than any of the other guys, you know, from the... And I think that was part of the deal. It was like, you know... That's showbiz, right? There's not like a lot of practice for anything.
Yeah, no, you got to nail it the first time.
The Stig gig was very much like that, where they would have me do, like, you know, I didn't even talk to them on the radios. So they would just say on the radio, we need you to come through here. They'd like give me a car. We need you to come through here, fourth gear corner, slide it up against the wall, and we're all set up, and there's camera crews in all sorts of crazy spots where you're like, that's not really great that they're there. And so you'd get one take and you'd slide the car through. That was the Stig gig.
And then you do a timed hot lap with...
Yeah.
Would you practice before that, or was it like three laps kind of thing?
No, you would just do blocks of laps, never more than five or six total in any car. And it was all... The only reason you got that many was they had three camera crews.
And they had to move
And them. They moved locations.
Yeah. Wow.
So you do like two laps, move locations, two laps, move locations. If they didn't get it, you had two more... Because they moved locations a third time, and that was that was the thing, and it was actually really fun, incredibly lonely. I joked that I didn't talk to anybody. Tanner's the only person who knew who I was.
Yeah.
And so he would come and visit me. I would always have like a Chrysler minivan, and I'd be like sequestered off to the far reaches. I remember like at Willow Springs, like
fucking
I've got
boring.
All these spots, and I would just like I'd buy things off Amazon, and I would do push-ups and sit-ups. That was my day. And then I would drive a car for like 5 minutes.
I mean, honestly, the self-control to spend that time doing push-ups and sit-ups, though, is...
It is.
That's something.
I'm not saying I did them all day,
but I've been sequestered on the other side of a fucking set waiting for shit to happen, and I assure you, I didn't elect to spend that time doing push-ups and sit-ups. Different personalities.
Yeah, but it was fun. And you know, you got to go... I traveled all over and did it, and I still... Like, actually, today, right now, I could be working for the Grand Tour today.
But
I'm here
to.
Doing this because it's way better.
You could, but it's not a good show, and so you don't want to.
No, I
you have the benefit of seeing the Grand Tour and knowing it's not a good show ahead of time now.
I'm okay with what we do on it, how it
what
turns
do
out in
it?
The I drive.
Oh, well, I'm not talking about the fucking driving.
Well,
I'm talking
see?
About the plot.
That's why
gives
I go
a shit about the driving. Of course it's the fucking driving. You can get defensive. All right, I'll give you the driving is great.
All I care about is the drive.
Of course.
Yeah, because that's the only thing I have any input or
of
control over. Yeah,
dude, when I do TV stuff and it's my job to be this guy, the talking driving guy, and the producer says, let's bring in the stunt driver to be you, I lose my shit.
Yeah.
I'm not about that. Make them let me do it, and if I break something, then you can bring in the stunt driver.
Right.
But, like, I get real fucking annoyed. Like, I don't care about the talking. I don't care about the reviewing. I'm like, that slide better be me doing it.
Right.
That's the only thing
my
I give a
shit honor about. Is at stake here. Sir.
Yeah.
Sir.
Yeah. It is. And there's shit that is like so risky it's not worth it. Like, you know, I pick a fucking cliffside, you know, supercar slide. Like, all right, I'll pass on that.
Right.
If we're on a racetrack, though, that dude can fucking wait in his minivan. He can go do push-ups, bro.
And there's my life.
It's the only thing I care about.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't blame you. I mean, I would want to do it all
if
as
you
well.
Were on camera and someone
totally.
Brought in a stunt driver for you, you'd be fucking pissed, wouldn't you?
Yeah, yeah, I would be.
Yeah.
No doubt about it. But I always joke,
this.
It's either too risky or too boring. That's
right.
When we drive.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the time they drive.
That's actually very funny. Mm-hmm. You drive if it's too risky or too boring.
Yeah.
Yeah, the we need to get some helicopter shots of this thing going 60 across the desert for the next week. You available?
Yeah, exactly. The presenters are like, nope.
Yeah.
They have to retrace their path across Botswana.
That's
totally what
that's
we do.
True.
Yeah, we do all the pickup shots, the ups and downs.
You drive the competition route in reverse.
Yeah, to exactly. Get the fucking they just turn around and drive it in the same direction. They turn around again to the same direction.
Mm-hmm.
But it's good fun. The crews are awesome. I love working with those guys, and there's great camaraderie, and it's really fun to do. And they always let you do like the crazy shot that you know won't make it into the show, but they'll let you do it anyway. And I love that they let you do that because they want to see it.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
Yeah, they're like, do a slow, medium, fast. Fast never gets used, but that's the one everyone wants to see.
Because it's too fast.
Yeah.
It's, I find it very interesting about driving on television. You know, it's really the slide that makes it look fast. You have to be going an unbelievable speed if you're driving clean to make it look even remotely quick.
And it won't. I don't think it does.
It's only really for
the trained eye.
Yeah.
I think if you go see a Formula One car and they're not sliding, that is quick because it is. I mean, like, you know, 5Gs of whatever is going to get your attention.
I mean, mm-hmm. More just street cars
street
on TV,
car,
not Formula One cars.
No, yeah. And that, you know, hence why we hate most Hollywood, you know, film car chases because they're sloppy on purpose mm-hmm. and it drives you nuts.
Mm-hmm. Well, I feel like they've gotten too sloppy because drifting's gotten so popular, and I'm a huge fan of drifting.
Yeah.
Like, it's the most fun.
Yeah.
But I watched like a bad TV promo, and it was a Charger versus Charger chase. They sponsored the show or something, but it was just slide, 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 slide. It's like,
It gets old.
It just saturates. Yeah, it gets old.
Yeah, it saturates. You're right. And then you're like, what's next? And they're all scratching their heads going, yeah. How are we going to move?
Well, then they're
going to
drag a safe through Brazil.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Smash fucking everything.
Exactly.
Are you okay?
Wreck more cars.
Bullet chase scene. Thumbs up, thumbs down.
The original Bullet.
Yeah, the original.
No, I loved it.
Yeah. You a fan?
No, I'm okay with it. I think that was a cool chase scene.
What's your favorite chase scene?
I think they did a really good
though.
Job. I would probably go with Ronan.
I go with Ronan.
Yeah, and I like the M5 one in uh-huh. Paris.
Yes.
Not the later one with the S8.
With the S8.
You're right, with nitrous. The M5 one was really good.
Yeah,
there's some good stuff. I mean, there's definitely some amazing things that are being done now. But again, it has to be the right tone and not overdone, which is what a lot of it ends up being.
Yeah. Like, I love the Gone in 60 Seconds one until the truck jump.
Yep.
Until he jumps the bridge, I think that one is really ace.
That's a very solid. Yeah, it's a solid.
It's
chase.
A really good one.
And the slides are like. They look legitimate. Like, he's coming around a corner, it's wet.
Yeah.
He, you know, it steps out, and that's an error, and then it's accelerating.
Yeah. I like the Hummer and the Ferrari and the Rock. I mean, that's
just good fun.
I mean,
right?
It's Michael Bay, but it's a little
before
Michael Bay.
I don't like the slow car, fast car keeping up with each other thing that they always have.
But
like the
slow car has to crash through shit.
Yeah.
It takes a shortcut.
That's cool.
Then you go.
They got to make it work. I'm okay with that.
Bro, if you jumped a 355 Spider down a street in San Francisco, you would banana the fuck out of that thing on landing.
Well, he jumped out of the showroom, right? Yeah. And that's like a 2-foot drop.
Yeah, I mean, he already does. No, he takes it from the valet. No, did he get it from the showroom?
Remember? No, he takes it, but then later he like goes down, you know, in a garage, and he has to floor it and punch through glass and then land and turn. Yeah. It wouldn't work.
You remember when you were mentioned I was like 1,000 years old earlier?
Yeah.
Okay, how about like Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry?
I don't know what that is at all.
I've seen the chase scene.
No, fuck is that at all?
No.
Is that a movie?
Yeah.
Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry?
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
I'll check it out.
See,
is it good? How old is it?
How about, have you seen the original Vanishing Point?
Yes.
Original Gumball Rally?
I have seen the Gumball Rally is actually one of my favorite of that period,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
There's a pacing that I'm 36, and I think there's a pacing of films that are like pre-75 mm-hmm. where they seem like hollow and empty to me, as a where they don't fill in like background sounds as much, there isn't like background music as much, and they don't pace it with music the same way,
right?
So it feels weird.
Dude, try to watch Easy Rider without being on drugs.
Oh, Easy Rider,
because my parents showed me when I was 10. I was like, this is a 2-hour music video. That's all it is.
Even, and I think Lamar sucks too.
I love it.
As a movie,
the tone is actually correct.
Oh, that's a lot
racing,
of not going
what,
on until racing.
That's what doing. That's what racing's really like. Mm. It's really like that. I do adore that movie.
So you watch him just like walking through the pits and there's no dialogue and you're like, that's what happens.
That's it. I'm not saying it makes a great movie. That's just the point. Sitting in the car listening to your own heartbeat
is how it is.
It's a true documentary about racing.
It is a documentary about racing.
Yeah,
and
set against the backdrop
that was
of fiction.
His problem.
It's meant to be fiction, but
that was his. Actually, what was funny was I did this race, a different race. It was just a jump car race now they call it Champ Car for some reason. But anyway.
Wait, really?
In Virginia. Yeah.
They renamed Champ Car?
Champ Car bought the rights to Champ Car.
Fuck off.
Yeah.
Well, first off,
we're all
good
mad
for
about
them.
It.
That's very smart. If that was, if that came up and he, is it John who did that?
I don't know.
That's fucking genius if he did that. And good for them.
Yeah. So I was doing a race and my car broke in the middle of the night. And I wasn't in it, and I was like looking for it, and there it is, and, you know, and it's up on jacks, and they're like, it's done, you know. I'm like, okay. So I'm like putting my stuff away, and I get a knock on the RV door, and it's a guy from another team, and they're like, we're in the lead, and we need a closer, and everyone's too tired. We need you to drive our car. And I was like, it's like Michael Delaney.
Like, and I'm like, yeah, I'll do it.
You.
Of course you'll do it. Other teams are like, that's not fair.
Yeah, exactly. So I jumped in the car and did an hour and a half. We won, yeah. Nice. So it was cool. So it was fun because it, you know, just kind of get the call up and you go. So it's no big deal. It's Champ Car, but...
That's what happens when you're good. People just knock on your RV door and ask. First off, when you're good, you have an RV.
I think cost us nothing. It was a good deal that Matthew Johnson, I don't know if you know Matthew Johnson, but he's one of the local SAG-AFTRA stunt guys, good friends with.
Not the rally filming guy. That Matt Johnson?
Yes.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah, I know
Chrissy
that
Beavis
Matt
is,
Yes. I do know
usually
him.
Known as.
He was at GridLife.
Yeah.
He was doing, that guy, he's awesome because he comes up, what's the name of his company? I can't remember. But he comes up with the crazy rig, camera rigs.
Oh.
Like the cable cams that go through.
Oh, this is
the,
a different guy.
Different Matt Johnson.
This is a different Matt Johnson.
Okay, I was wondering.
This is a rally driver, Matt Johnson, but he...
The Matt Johnson I'm talking about is a rally focused, like a film guy. And he really gets some really difficult to get shots that look impossible.
Cool.
And he comes up with like crazy RC cable cams and wild drone stuff and... He's
I
a
love
cool
all
guy.
That.
Yeah, I know. He's great.
Sounds like I need to know him, too.
What did that say? Is that... Did you find one of the... Which one did you find, Tim?
That
driver.
That's my buddy.
That's the driver,
that's
Matthew Johnson.
Guy. Yeah.
Was he driving a Toyota IQ?
Yeah, he did that factory as a factory driver.
Hell yeah.
He was happy and almost, you know, and embarrassed at the same time. But it was awesome. He had a factory drive. So
I got
good.
A factory ride.
And
what
won.
Is it?
Yeah.
IQ?
Yeah.
And he won?
Yeah.
Yeah. Fuck, there you go.
Yeah, front wheel drive.
My car sucks. I won a trophy with it. Fuck yourself.
Yeah.
Is that front wheel drive too? Or all wheel drive?
No, front wheel drive.
Fucking. Front wheel drive rally is hard.
Yeah, it is.
So hard.
Get the wheel straight. Carry corner speed.
Yeah.
Right?
Do you like rally? Are you into that?
I love rally. Yeah, I do.
Have you done much?
Not much, other than for shows and things. And then, you know, I did Pike's Peak back when it was half gravel.
Oh, really? In what kind of car?
In a Wells Coyote.
What's a Wells Coyote?
It's a tube chassis open class car. Tanner and I actually rented cars together and did it.
You can rent this thing for Pike's Peak?
Oh, yeah. We of course. This was 2002. I was 3 weeks
Wells
out of back
Coyote,
surgery.
Tim?
Yeah.
Coyote?
That seems like a real good time. Just doing that on dirt back in the day? Oh, man. Whoa.
Wow.
It's like
all right. It looks like a... Sprint buggy with wings in the front.
So they're rear-engined with a Pantera gearbox that's flipped over, so the shift pattern's backwards.
Wait, it's backwards?
Yeah, it's down and to the right for first.
Oh, my God.
And then so it was really
so
weird.
So it's like
but
driving
two
on
gears.
The right seat. That's very strange.
Gears.
Third and fourth, back and forth,
yeah,
pretty much?
Yeah, that was it. My car never ran. Man. It broke constantly.
The front tires look like they're a third of the size of the rear.
Yeah,
in every way.
I said the same thing, and they go, the front tires don't matter. And I'm like, well, I'll be the judge of that. And I drove it, and I came back. I'm like,
you're
front
like,
tires
you're
don't
right.
matter.
Are you just managing slide the whole time?
That car would wheelie and slide at the same time.
Oh, that sounds like the best thing in the world.
That's the best feeling ever.
That's fucking awesome.
You'd feel the front skipping. Like, you'd feel the right front come off the ground and you're looking through
and
the corner.
Ding, ding, ding.
Yeah, you're looking through the corner. So you're not like seeing it, but you're like, I feel it through the wheel. And then you feel the whole thing go light, the steering go light, and you're like, oh, they're both off the ground.
That's fucking
cool.
Nuts.
Holy
how long can
shit.
I make it do that?
Wait, can you zoom in on the center of the engine there, Tim? Am I looking at is that the
sprint,
air cleaner right between
car.
The exhaust?
No, well, it's in front of it. Away,
that's a weird one. Yeah,
it's velocity weird. Stacks.
Yeah.
Oh, velocity into an air with an air box.
But what you're seeing is the Canyon air filter aimed down like an elephant's trunk, almost between the wheels.
Yeah,
right
and
in
the
dust.
And
that's
exhaust.
Where you want the air. To,
the
I don't know why you wouldn't
place
put that
ever.
up. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, like they could have 180 degreed that.
Yeah, I know. Put it in some clean air. Get some ram air.
That
maybe.
Must have been amazing.
It must be some ride though.
Super fun. Well, the car I run now is more fun. The NV8 hypercar. Look
what
that
is the
one, look
NV8?
That one
wait, this is the electric thing?
No. ENVIATE hypercar.
Oh, wait. Hang on a second. ENVIATE? NV8?
NV8, yeah.
That's a word.
NV8 hypercar, there it is. So that's the car that... That car I ran.
Oh, that's the fucking thing. I saw you at Grid Life.
That's right. That's where we met.
That, remember, they were he was running this thing in May.
I did one lap and it caught
at Gingerman.
But it was a good lap.
Yeah, we saw that. We're like, what the hell is this thing?
Oh, yeah. I saw this thing and like was mind blown. Okay, tell it for the radio audience not looking at the pictures. What the fuck is this thing?
It's a prototype. So that like the type of car you'd run at Le Mans has 1,000 horsepower of the wheels. It has 7,000 pounds of downforce.
7,000 pounds?
Yeah, at 150 miles an hour.
It looks tiny. I mean,
it's tiny. It's like a, you know, if you ever see like a prototype, they're less than waist high.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Yeah. So like a supercar is
turbo LS?
Twin turbo LS. We finished second in the unlimited class last year in 2017. Tried to run it this year.
At Pikes Peak?
Yeah, caught on fire. And we didn't get to run, unfortunately, right before the event. So too much damage to the car. But it's so much fun to drive.
That's such a shame. I mean, how crazy is
that?
In
fourth gear, it accelerates at 1.8 G in fourth gear.
That's wild.
Yeah, you got less than 2,000 pounds, you know.
What's the gearbox?
It's actually a Porsche gearbox.
Oh, it's a 915 or something?
Yeah, 915, built 915.
Is the shifter fucked up, or is it all right?
No, it's normal, because this one's mid-engined. The Wells Coyotes, they flip it around, so it's rear-engined, so the gearbox has to be backwards. That's where you get
In a Pantera, the gearbox would be behind the engine, and now it's in front of
Bingo.
The engine.
Bingo, you got it.
Ugh, what a pain in the dick.
Yeah.
I drove a vintage Bugatti, like a 23 Bugatti. Type 35 that had the inverted shift pattern.
Nothing will mess with your head.
It was
more than changing something fun. It's like when they had the brake pedal switched around, you know, and the gas pedal in the old cars too.
Oh my God, I drove a car that had that too.
How to crash.
Actually, now that I think about it, flipped pedals were more confusing than flip shifter.
I don't know that I've never have driven one like that.
Dude, it'll fuck you up.
I wouldn't even.
I mean, even you, who is provably amazing, you throw a curveball like that.
No. Ingrained. How do you not do that?
Alpha 8C 2300 Grand Prix.
So cool. I would love to do it.
I'd
probably move my feet over.
Gas pedal in the middle, brake on the right.
Oh, right.
And the gas pedal's a wheel. I fucking hate when they do that. The rolly pedal?
Yeah.
Do you remember when we went to New Zealand and we rented mountain bikes? And so we're renting our bikes. I'm putting my helmet on, and Tom, our cameraman's with us, and he just starts pedaling around, and he's been, you know, biking for decades in road cycling, and he just yells out, "The brake levers are switched. The brake levers are switched."
Now, that is how my bikes rear, my bikes are set up like
really?
That, because I was actually born in England.
No way.
And that's how you do it, and everywhere else in the world is the front brakes on the right.
Wait,
and
we are the only country with weird bikes?
Of course we are. And of course, motorcycles are all like that.
Yeah.
So for some reason, so I'm like, it's called moto style in the U.S. That's what they call it. It's moto style when you put your right brake on.
Sure, I never thought of that. And there was a time where I owned a motorcycle and a mountain bike, and I never got switched up. But in New Zealand, we're going over the bars.
All of a sudden, it's impossible. Right.
That's so funny.
That shows you how important psychology is when you're doing anything like that, right? Where it's just like that, where you actually know how to brake with your right hand for the front brake on your motorcycle, but put it on a bike and all of a sudden your whole game
is
thrown off.
I'm like, no, on a bike it works this way. Yeah. Motorcycle works
even though
this
you
way.
Actually do have the muscle memory to do it, because you can ride a motorcycle.
Have you ever ridden a motorcycle with fucked up controls, like a Vincent or one of those things where the shifter's on the other
side? It's a dream to own a Vincent or a Brawl.
What are those things going
like
for
that
these days? Is it so crazy?
50, 70, I think. Least,
for a Vincent?
I think, yeah, like a not a cool one.
Like a shitty Vincent?
Yeah, not a Black Shadow, but like a, you know, one of their lesser known models you can get. And the Brawl Superiors, I think those are 100 something, you know, all
jeez
that.
I mean, that's a lot, but it's not like it's, I don't know, millions.
In car dollars, it's the equivalent of the $70 million car. So
totally,
it's kind of cool.
Well, the Vincent Black Shadow is the bike, right? Yeah. If you're going to have a collector bike, that's the one.
Yeah.
I just have no idea what they're worth.
Yeah, yeah, they're up there.
That
I had a friend
of
that had
Richard
one.
Hammond didn't seem to enjoy riding it too much.
No, he and I talk about that a lot, because I have bikes as well, and so we were chatting about his Vincent last time I was working with him, because
is that one on the show? His?
Yeah, yeah, he has about 50 or 75 motorcycles. And
holy
they're cool
crap!
They're cool. Like he's way into it.
Yeah, well, he's into a lot of things, apparently. Helicopters and
he's
shit,
got a,
too, right?
A Robinson helicopter, all that.
It's pretty rad.
Yeah, he's a
wait, so what was the Richard Hammond verdict on the long trip on a Vincent?
No, he rides it all the time.
Really?
So I don't know about the long trip thing.
It was a film that they did, and I, you know,
Was that racing the train?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It could be complete horseshit for all I know. But I saw him riding it through the rain and the cold and he didn't look too happy. Yeah. So I assume
well, that's part of the show.
Well, that Grand Tour they did in Africa on that road and he rode the bike and just fell over like 80 times. Yeah. That was hilarious.
It was hilarious.
Because all of those falls are real. You know, like they don't need to be intentional. Yeah. He's actually falling on the ground.
Yeah.
How many times have you done Pike's Peak?
Only twice, technically.
Only twice.
Yeah.
And you started with a sprint car, and then you went, yeah, that was fun. I need 1,000 horsepower.
That's kind of like my messed up mentality. Like, I don't like slow anything.
Uh-huh.
And I actually do a lot better. I have a lot of trouble focusing if the race car isn't fast enough. I need to be like have my head in the game and be mentally challenged.
That.
I can do it. It's just more work for me. But you put me in something really fast.
So for
and
you,
I'm
that
on it.
Psycho Death Machine is easier to drive than a chump car.
Super easy to drive.
How do you super mentally prepare yourself for something with 7,000 pounds of downforce?
It you know, just practice, man. I mean, just like anything else.
How far when you're in your
visualize.
First lap? How far are you off the pace?
Oh, I'm quite a bit off the pace. Like, yeah. I'm right there. Again, slow corners, medium corners, fast corners, right? Just like we talked about earlier. So in a slow corner, I jump in that thing and I drive it because there's no downforce in a 30-mile-an-hour hairpin. You know, by the time I'm getting to a medium corner, there's getting to be some downforce, and I start exploring that, and then I get comfortable with that, and I just move it up. You know, and that's the same process that I would teach anyone to do. I do it myself. It's the only safe way to do it. And eventually, you get to the point where I've got the 7,000 pounds of downforce and I'm railing through 150-mile-an-hour corner in the car and letting the thing kind of slide along and feeling really good about it, you know.
Yeah,
but that's not like in one day. That's, you know, was kind of like it took, because that car never ran long enough to really do that. It took me
That car seem to work properly?
So you can't, and maybe we could have someone come in at the end of this and say, I have a solution for you. But evidently, don't hold my breath. All right. But because I've talked to some really good people, and actually I have a call into Steve Dinan, who you had on earlier, who's a dear friend, and I'm trying to get him to find a solution. So
he's smart, but YouTube commenters, they're smarter. They'll know.
Without a doubt, yes. Yeah.
Make sure the ones with the anonymous usernames; those are the ones to really listen to.
They have been there and done that.
Yeah,
that we can
trust
be sure
them.
Of.
Trust them.
Trust their
they
experience.
Know.
That's right. So running an LS 1,000 horsepower. Now that doesn't sound like a big deal. Like it doesn't get anyone to kind of go, "Wow, wait a minute! Did you just say 1,000 horsepower twin turbo LS?" Because it's commonplace.
Yeah.
How long do they run for at that horsepower level?
That's a question.
Not 8 minutes.
No.
Mm.
The longest you can run one for, completely built LS. So far, we have the record. You can get one to go almost 3 minutes.
Really?
That car is so streamlined. Is it also like you have minimal cooling for weight? And
we
you
have
know,
tons
like,
of cooling.
Tons
we have,
of cooling.
We have, we're also at starting at 9,000 feet.
Yeah. Right.
So we have basically a third less air to deal with. You know, by the time you get to the top, third less air. So you know, we do all the math. We have the Sauber F1 team helps us with this car. They do all the calculations. So you know, they do the aero, they do all the mechanical stuff for this car. So everything's really good. They do the calculations. They're like, this should work. You've got way more radiator area than you need. But you also need to factor in the actual cylinder block's cooling capacity. How much water does it hold? And then that's a ratio. So you can keep making the radiators as big as you want. If you're not able to get the heat out of the block because the block isn't moving enough water through there, you can speed up the pumps, you can slow down the pumps, you can do whatever you want. It's complicated.
Right.
Wow.
And so the LS doesn't have enough jacketing, it seems like, to last 8 minutes at 1,000 horsepower.
Oh, that's interesting.
Not even close. And I mean, I've talked to Tom Nelson of Nelson Racing Engines, who builds engines like nobody's business, right?
Yeah.
And
he's the guy.
They're like, this is uncharted territory.
So how long does a Nelson engine last?
These are
$100,000 engines.
They are, but they do quarter mile passes. They do half mile passes. They do standing mile passes, and then they cool down
and they cruise around. Like because so I know there are
most
people
drag racing cars
around.
Don't even have radiators. They them up and they go right.
Yeah,
and then
they
shut them off in few seconds.
But all these fucking people are talking about 1,000 horsepower reliable, and that's all horseshit.
That's not true. It's not under load.
That's the
any length of time.
Right.
Yeah.
How long do you keep the throttle cracked open in
your car?
I completely understand. Yeah.
I understand. I asked Mountune. I have a Focus RS.
Love that car.
It's interesting. I asked Mountune if they could reprogram the overboost so that it came on earlier, but instead of the 20 seconds, I got 10. Because I don't need 20. When the fuck can I go flat for 20?
Right.
Never.
Right.
So give me 10 and give it to me at 5,000 RPM and 3/4 throttle instead of 6,000 RPM and full throttle, right?
Yeah.
The numbers aren't right. I made them up, but you can understand. And they said, can't be done.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. But to go back to your LS engines, is this engine a standard block?
It is right now, but the standard block tend to have more water jacketing than the aftermarket cool stuff because they're made
to be drag
stronger
blocks.
And they know they don't have to last very long. Mm. So we're working on that. RHS and Dart both make billet blocks for that car. We hear the RHS one is the one to get. And so maybe we'll build one of those. Hopefully do. They're just bucks.
It's not your car though, right?
It's not my car. No, yeah. No, it's kind of a team. And there's actually getting to be two of them. One of them, is owned by, the team I raced with it this year, which is Force Engineering. And then the next, the old car and the new car are built by the same guy, Cody Loveland, who was at Grid Life, and he lives nearby Michigan there where Gingerman is. Mm-hmm. And he's the guy that designed the car. I saw it basically on Facebook at sitting at PRI. I wasn't at PRI. I saw this picture. I'm like, that looks like a Pikes Peak car.
Yeah.
And I messaged him, and he recognized my name, and he's like, how tall are you? I'm 5'7", because the car actually, it turns out, only fits, like, I'm big to get in that
really?
Car.
And you're not big.
No, I'm not.
You're small.
I'm a little.
What was that dark blue
guy.
Car you drove at?
Oh, I drove the Praga R1
oh, right.
that was renamed Griffin or some shit, I think, later. Griffin Racing.
They just look in comparable size and shape.
You yeah, know, the Praga was smaller, little. I could barely fit in it.
Yeah.
But that was my first ever... Yeah, there it is. That was my first ever downforce car. It was fucking cool. And yeah. it's like a Renault Sport, you know, four-cylinder or something.
Right, right.
It was only like 250 horsepower, but...
Proper felt, downforce.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I can
I was
see
at
it.
Monticello.
Oh, yeah.
York,
that's where it was.
And I assume you've been there a bunch. You know, at the back, the blind over crest?
Yes, yes.
I took that flat for the first time ever in that car.
Don't try it in anything else.
Fuck no. No. The next time I went out there, I was in a McLaren 570. Yeah. I was at the wall.
Exactly.
Scary.
If I remember right, this is flat. Yeah. Famous last words department.
Only in that, man. But when I did it, I was like, this is what downforce is.
Yeah. It's an amazing thing. It was funny. I've had the same experience, but they were talking about going over like Flugplatz at the Nürburgring or any of those big unweight moments when you have a downforce car and the car sticks to the crest,
but your body
and you go up into the seatbelts.
Wow!
Right?
Yeah.
It's a funny thing
that
to
is,
just contemplate.
You don't have downforce.
You get thrown up. So you get like a little zero G moment. You could let go of your space pen and it would just fly there in front of you, you know, and then you pick it up again.
And then you hit the wall because you were looking at a space pen.
Well, yeah. I'm an
Don't
author,
look
so
at
I always have my
pen.
Space pen
right.
with me in case I need to jot something down at the
upside down into a wall.
Yeah, exactly. You could write down. Fuck,
don't do that again.
Yeah. Have you got a lot of laps at the ring?
Yeah, I used to teach for BMW there, so I've driven there quite a bit.
Cool.
And I adore that place.
How do you not?
It really well. There are people that are like, it's overrated. I'm like, It's not overrated. And I dream of driving the NV8 there and trying to beat the 919's lap time.
Well,
that's kind of a dream.
That video,
oh my
is
goodness,
crazy.
That was PlayStation. I've run like a 4:55 on PlayStation or something like that. Gone below 5 minutes there, and I'm watching that lap. I'm like, this looks very familiar.
Yeah, like, that shit was nuts.
That was really cool.
Yeah, that was really cool.
But again, it's easy on a downforce car. It's sketchier to drive. Like, let's say you're driving a road car that doesn't have a lot of downforce. Say like a
Viper.
Oh, a Viper, but a Viper does actually have pretty good downforce. But if you're to drive something like an Ariel Atom without the wings on it, but a lot of power, that's probably a scarier lap than that 919.
That I've driven Ariel Atoms before. They are hairy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even the ones with the wings are
the
still
one I drove
hairy.
At Top Gear, I set the track record with on the U.S. course, and that thing was
scary. The El Toro course?
Yeah, it was scary to drive that car. I mean, it's snap. We were talking about the Vipers having snap issues, and the Atom has snap issues,
too. The first Atom I drove was in the wet in Seattle, and it was... shady.
Yeah, right.
On top of getting soaked,
I want
it was
to like
shady.
This, but now I'm just happy I'm alive.
Yeah,
it's
right?
Like it has like Porsche weight distribution, but with less weight in the front, right? It's just a pendulum.
No,
it seems.
It's not that. It's not that. Whenever you have a car that like breaks away suddenly, it's usually a torsional issue with the chassis. Like the thing winds up, and they release.
I felt like I could feel the chassis flexing.
That's
in
what
the
I'm
Atom.
Saying.
You too?
Yeah.
Okay,
that's what
cool.
I'm saying.
God, it's not just me. When I feel shit like this,
it's the same. Actually, I have the same thing when you're talking about Corvettes, but Vets are like that for me.
Oh,
I like the Camaro over the Vet.
Really?
Oh yeah. I just think it's
You're 5'7". That's the big
maybe
difference.
Maybe that's it. But I'm just saying, purely dynamics wise, and the new vet's a lot better.
ZL1 1LE is fucking rad.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's rad.
Really.
So
really
fast
good.
And so good.
I just drove the Hennessy version of that called the Exorcist.
Yeah. It's 1,000 horsepower or something.
To the wheels. And it runs on, like, you know, one.
I think you
got to
see
C-16.
If it runs 8 minutes.
But yeah. that thing spins the tires at a genuine 100, and it is. But the chassis is so good that you're like, yes,
they have done such a good job with that chassis that you could probably run a bunch of power through.
Really
it.
Impressive.
And that PTM thing they have, the performance traction thing, is really, really good. I had the ZR1 at Road Atlanta, the new one, which is a hairy motherfucker. It's 750.
Right.
And in mode like 4 and even mode 5, it'll let you get almost flat without anything happening at the back end. It's pretty, you can hear it. It does that kind of low rumble noise when it kicks in.
Yeah.
But like, it'll save you.
Yeah.
Ish. It'll save you on the exit. Save you in the entrance.
It's another problem though with, you know, getting back, even chatting about driver training, stability and traction control systems and people relying on those things and not having to earn, you know, the ability. And then you can have those systems kind of freak out, shut down. You lose a wheel speed sensor because you pick up a piece of gravel and it just takes out one of your wheel speed sensors. Or you get enough brake dust on a wheel speed sensor and you can lose a wheel speed sensor on a track day. Mm. And all of a sudden your system's just shut down mid-lap. You get a bunch of lights, but you're in the middle of the 140 mile an hour corner.
You know,
and the guy doesn't have the basic car control to do anything right now. And it's a big crash. Oh, there's nothing I could do. It's like, you put yourself there.
Well, that's what's interesting with people that, if, you know, they focus their life on working in a lucrative business of some kind, and then they turn 30-ish or 40-ish, and they go, I like cars. I'm going to start track driving, but I have this much money, and buy a 911 or a GT3 or something that's fast. And that's their school car, basically.
Yeah.
And they can have a big problem.
Big, you know, people buy GT3s. They buy, every, you know, runs the gamut, McLarens,
did
whatever.
You know that 40% of 911s sold in 2017 are GT cars? 40%?
That's staggering.
I read that and I didn't think it was real. I had to call them and confirm it. 40%
of
911s.
How many 911s did they sell? Like,
I don't know the exact number.
15,000?
Yeah, something like that.
Something like that?
It's in the tens of thousands. It's a lot of GT cars.
It's a lot of money.
It's a lot of GT cars.
It's a very
40% of, they make 46 varieties of the 911?
Right?
And 40% of them are the three versions of the GT cars.
That's
isn't that
amazing,
crazy?
Because they always make you think, well, there's only three of these things here. You know,
in your
color combo. Is unique.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. Yeah.
And they are lovely, though.
But they're great cars and a great company. I mean, a smart company in the way they market the product. Mm-hmm. And they're extremely profitable as a manufacturer.
Oh, yeah. Most, I think.
Yeah, which is crazy. And they're leading J.D. Power. On top of all that,
that's crazy.
Like for customer satisfaction. So
this
like,
is why it's expensive, folks.
Yeah.
I'm going to PEC tomorrow, actually.
Oh, cool.
They just announced, you know, pretty much if you've gone to PEC in the past, it's pretty much an intro to Porsche, intro to sports car driving thing they do. And after a while, they realized we have nothing for advanced drivers. And so they are now offering an advanced program.
Good.
Which I am going to sample for the benefit of the audience tomorow morning.
Very
cool.
Good. Well,
so
maybe I'm going to give you a copy of the book. You can take it with you.
You're going to give me one anyway, right?
Yeah,
I
of
read
course.
It. I want to read it. I'll bring it down. I'll shove
it
in their face.
Beforehand. What happened?
Labor Day weekend, bro. let's go over to the Super Chat. We got a bunch of questions from the fans for the next 20 or so. And if you want to get in there with Paul Gerard, if you're watching live, get in the Super Chat right now. Jesse would like to know, I drive a Fiesta ST in the DC metro area. What should I do to make the ride better? Smaller wheels and bigger tires? Minor rally/safari build? What would you do to improve the ride of a Fiesta ST in a city with terrible roads?
Yeah, the simple thing to do would be to go with like a rally wheel tire setup, as far as like some 15 or 16 inch rims with some nice tall sidewalls, like a 60 series, maybe 70 series
some
if you're really feeling
Team
brave.
Dynamics wheels.
Some really cool Team Dynamics wheels, whatever you can fit over the brakes, because that's going to be the limiting factor, right, with what clears the front caliper.
I think you can get 16s at least, maybe even 15s on a Fiesta.
And then maybe go to a more of a touring tire, and that would have a bit more of a cushy sidewall than a high-performance tire. Obviously, there are trade-offs in
performance. The Bridgestones that come with the Fiesta have really good turn-in, but they have really hard sidewalls. So if you go to even a Pilot Supersport has a squishier sidewall, and you might lose a little on the turn-in, but you have about the same grip at the limit.
Yeah.
I just did, because you said you like the Focus RS.
Love it.
So I like a lot of things about mine, but I also didn't like a bunch of things as well, and I've gone well out of my way to change
them. Here we go.
So we did the KWDDC adaptive coilovers, okay, which is a plug-and-play replacement.
Cool.
Completely fixed the ride.
Good.
Almost fixed the ride. Then 1552 just made me a set of their Lancia Integrale-style wheels.
Oh, I love that.
And I did
already.
Pull it up on the Instagram. Yeah. Tip, and I did a minus one.
Like a
so they're 18s.
Kind of. Yeah. I love those wheels.
It's right there. So it's on 18s now instead of 19s. So
good move.
It takes the hard edge off some of the potholes and stuff. It's really nice. I'm a big fan of it, and it fits over the stock brakes.
I can't believe I'm saying this, but I actually approve of your modifications.
Yeah.
Well, I don't often get to say
no,
that.
No, yeah. We did the Mountune. Sensible. I don't know what they're calling the package now, but it's just like intake, exhaust, intercooler, up pipe, and the tune, and it's 377, 455 on 91 octane at the wheels.
That's crazy.
Fucking fast. And we just got the 100 octane tune, and I haven't put it on a dyno yet, but I filled up with a tank 100, and it feels stout.
If you could see the look in his eyes right now, guys.
It's like an evil. Dude, better be that 100 octane tune.
Yeah,
we got a plus 50 on the Fiesta ST with the 100 octane tune. That thing was fast.
That was fun car.
Fiesta ST was great.
Super fun.
Great city car.
I caught so much heat. I do car reviews for this YouTube channel, and I did the Fiesta ST, and I said I like it much more than the whatever the equivalent Civic GTR. Si is.
Oh yeah.
And you know, the Civic just understeered to me, and the Fiesta was super lively, super fun, pointed. You get the rear end out, you just drive it. You
great
drive
steering.
The car. Yeah, just drive that car. And man, I just got killed on the internet. Nobody, they're like, there's no way it's better than.
Well, more Civics have been sold than Fiesta.
They're like talking about car and drivers, lap times, and lightning nap. I'm like, I don't care about that. I'm talking about how fun it is to drive.
Yeah, yeah. The Type R is very good.
I haven't driven that yet.
It's very good.
I hope it is.
It doesn't need 20-inch wheels.
Yeah.
It's got 20s on
it. It looks horrible.
It does.
It does.
But there's a dude who I know who goes to track, and I can't remember his name right now, and I'm sorry if you're out there, but he's got one on 18s with, like, Hoosiers,
right,
and the mid-corner speed is staggering.
Oh, that's cool.
It's so fast. Yep. It's a great little car. Daniel, thanks for your donation. Sean says, best four-seat year-round sports car. $130,000.
I love his budget. Will you adopt me?
Like your budget.
Yeah, exactly.
Used Ferrari FF 991 Turbo S. Hauling kids in the back seat is important to have weekend fun. What do you think, Paul?
FF's got a much better back seat.
It's got a big back seat.
Huge.
You can fit adults in the
you
back seat.
You can fit an adult in the back. And it's got luggage room,
and
too.
Luggage. Yeah. And a glass roof, possibly.
It's a fucking Ferrari.
And it has a 720 horsepower naturally aspirated V12 that sounds like, you know.
Yeah.
Wow.
I'm a big fan of the 991 Turbo S.
Great car,
but
that's plain Jane compared
Ferrari
to an FF.
Ferrari FF is pretty cool.
I like the Repeat as well. Is actually a pretty good car, the V12.
Yeah.
You can sling
like
those
S.
around.
The S is
the V12. Yeah.
It's true.
But that's a fun driving car.
What's funny is that the back seat of the Repeat is about the same size as that in the Turbo.
Yeah.
It's got another door.
It's bigger.
The back seat of the Repeat sucks.
When I'm driving, because I'm
when you're driving,
seven.
It's fine.
Yeah, yeah. If Matt's driving.
I would hire you as a chauffeur, but I think I may have seen 4 or 5 Rapides in my entire life on the street. Like, very, very rare. Very rare.
I've had some awesome drives.
Gorgeous.
I used to do a bunch of work for Aston Martin, so I did the winter driving school they had at Crested Butte.
Oh.
And I used to drive it back and forth, like, to my house.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I live in Boulder, and I have some epic snowstorm drives in the Rapide. I haven't put winter
tires
on it.
How is it on snows? Is it good?
Fantastic.
I love, okay.
Just big,
so
slidey,
good. Oh,
wonderful.
My God.
Oh, it's
that'd
awesome.
Be the best.
This morning, so someone emailed me, actually, and said, you know, I live in Portland or Seattle or something.
Right.
And I want to buy a sports car to use all year. And he was talking about all-wheel drive 911s and stuff. I said, don't. Just get the snow tires. Skip the all-wheel drive. Yeah. Just get the
unless
fucking
you live
snow.
On the hill, that has you have to have all-wheel drive to get home.
Yeah.
Right. Other than that,
just get the snow tires. The thing is a beast.
Yeah.
Okay, Sean, we're going to go with the Ferrari on your question, Sean. What else can you get for a four-seat used? What about... May not like this. It's not a sports car. I would say Bentley Mulsanne if that, but is
I would do
Bentley
a
GT
M5.
I was gonna say you could save money and get a used M5 or even
a brand new one is 130
and it's a good looking car.
The new car is amazing, actually. If you've driven the new one,
it's
4-wheel drive and 2-wheel drive, you can switch it. But it's actually amazingly well developed in both modes, which I thought. Kudos to BMW for doing that. It'd be easy just to kind of AMG, you know, has their cars they can switch them to, but they're only really good in the 4-wheel drive mode. 2-wheel drive mode, they just want to drift. But the M5 actually puts power down in 2-wheel drive. It's really impressive.
I would only put my AMG in two-wheel drive if I wanted to drift.
Yeah.
yeah, okay, cool. Jason says, can we think of any cars that started increasing in price but eventually went the other way and fizzled out? So something that was a prospective collector car went up, but then it fizzled out and didn't go anywhere.
Well, I think a lot of cars have done that historically, right, where they have a moment where they sort of peak. Even 911s have just done that recently. Like 911Rs are going for a lot less money than they were 2 years ago.
Yeah. I mean, you know, definitely so, muscle cars from the 60s, yeah, you know, in 2007.
They went crazy. And
anything that is X number of years, I think if he's talking about like a rise from they've bottomed, they rise and then drop again, like muscle cars from the 60s, like that's probably going to be a generational thing.
Yeah.
And then, but if it's anything that's been like new and came out, was so popular and then fell off like when they released the next version.
I also think like Ferrari 308s went up and have now settled.
The 911R.
That's what I saw.
Yeah, 911R for sure.
Yeah,
is going to be the big one. But what else was very
599s? I think. Although they're coming back now.
I think
the
manual 360s and stuff have really settled a little bit.
I want a manual 430. That's the
manual
last 430s
one. Are fucking rad.
Yeah,
they're so good.
That's like my dream
one
car.
It was
kind of
delightful.
Yeah,
really, really good. Cool. Let's see what else. Munib says, "I've been here since podcast number one. Thank you, sir." Woo. Question: 2009. It says 991 turbo. That's wrong. It's 997 turbo. Metzger plus PDK equals winner. Any difference between the manual transmission 07 to 09 turbos? No.
Not that I'm aware of. I would always do manual over PDK.
Manual is forever.
Yeah.
Especially with a turbo, because they built so many PDK turbos.
And if you don't like a manual, it's just like you don't have, again, that experience. You're more like I have two categories of people that like this stuff. There's car enthusiasts, and then there's driving enthusiasts.
Mm-hmm.
And you can be both, but there's a lot of people car enthusiasts that are in the biz, and they're all over it, and they like the PDKs and the traction control and the stability control and all the technology. Like, this is awesome because I can drive a really fast car. But then there's driving enthusiasts that are like, I don't want any of that.
Yeah,
right.
I agree.
Much smaller.
Although PDK is an improvement on your traditional automatic transmission.
Absolutely. In Porsche's case, it's very well done. Ferrari does it very
well. Porsche is so good that PDK turns cars that shouldn't be Porsches into Porsches. Driven a Macan lately?
Yeah.
You know, go drive a Macan and drive any other midsize SUV.
Horrible around the track, though.
Well,
Well, even in the dirt, that clutch assembly for the center diff overheats in like 5 seconds, and you lose your all-wheel drive.
Oh, that's
almost right away.
I didn't know that.
Almost right away. It's like, what were they thinking? Kind of moment.
Probably that no one's going to actually do this.
No one's going to try and drive it hard in the dirt. I mean, if you try to do 2 minutes of donuts in the dirt, you'll make it through minute like.
There's a video of a RS4, I think, on like a rally or something, and it pulls off in a wet turnout and it starts doing donuts, and 25 seconds in you just start hearing and they shattered something bad.
RS4, okay. Now that was a fun car.
I think, you know, cars like that, the Macan is just not meant to handle that kind of abuse.
Has that name Porsche on it, and I think that should be a car that has been engineered to do anything.
Fair. That's
anything.
Fair.
Anything. That's what you spend your money on.
Well, the
to
new
be
one
honest.
Has that name Toucan on it, and it can't fly. So,
oh yeah. Well, that's true. It does have
I'm
a big
with
beak.
You on the should take abuse because it's a Porsche. If it was a 911, it would have.
That's the whole thing about that. Those particular brands are not supposed to be smoke and mirrors.
True.
Not
a good point.
Supposed to be smoke and
that's
mirrors.
A good point. However, I've driven most of the Macan's competition. And I can't guarantee that any of them would have fared better in your dirt donut test. And B, the Macan just drives better than all of them.
Yeah. But it's, you know, again, I just want it to do what a Porsche should do.
Fair.
Right? Which is everything. Have you ever, driven like the Cayenne Turbo S, which is like just staggeringly fast and handles incredibly well. And,
yeah.
You know, it's
my dad
like,
has a Cayenne
and
Turbo
you're just
S.
Like,
I'm not that big of a fan of it.
No, but it As an engineering exercise, it's impressive.
I just had the fucking Trackhawk, the Hellcat Jeep.
I drove one of those
Atlanta.
Too. Oh my goodness!
How long do the brakes last for you?
I didn't do many laps in a row, but it porpoised and hopped, and so it would get up on two wheels.
Yes.
If you start cornering it hard enough.
Yes, it does.
So you have to be careful.
I went
with it.
I rode Atlanta You know, the new curbing on turn three.
Oh, curbing, bad idea.
Well, I went. I just went. I go straight through the grass.
Oh,
you just go straight through the grass on
track
three.
Walk.
Yeah, and you get two laps. You get one where you can break at like the five at the end of the back straight, and then one where you got to break at like the nine if there was a nine, and then the third lap it's like 100 mile an hour limiter. I'm not fucking around anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
It was fast, but a little shady.
Yeah.
I'm not a big fan of SUVs. SUVs.
I don't
anymore.
Like them at all. Not at all.
I was real yeehaw about that shit for a while, but now I'm like, these are all dumb.
No, cars are where it's at, people.
I mean, I'm fine with an SUV, but like, I don't need an SUV that's good on a racetrack. Fuck do I care?
It's a pretender, you know. Yeah. It's like I deal with this all the time because, you know, just working in the industry. But like, our obsession in this country with SUVs. Man, I wish we'd just get over it because think about the fuel we're costing ourselves.
Yeah.
You think about the consumables and brake pads, and these are bigger, heavier vehicles and so on and so forth.
It's a slippery slope, right? Now everyone else has a tall car, so you want to have a tall car.
You know what? You can't see over them anyway. Move six inches to the left. That's what I do.
That's a fair argument.
Move six. You can be in the NV8 hypercar and just move 6 inches to the left, and that thing's I can see under SUVs. Okay, so that's not a good example, but anyway, any normal car, you just move a little left, and now you can see again.
I mean, I understand, but I just think in America that is the mindset.
I get it.
It's dumb.
Here's
what they got to do: make gas $6 a fucking gallon. I mean, honestly, you don't want to say that, right?
Yeah.
Because you don't want to go, well, this is going to affect people's lives negatively. But if someone is not of a lot of money and they're driving a fucking Expedition, come on,
getting 9-10 miles to the gallon,
if gas
complaining,
we like space. I think this country, just when we first got here, there was a fuck ton of space. People had ranches and houses. Like, we, you know, you go to England, the houses are smaller, the streets are smaller, you know, any of the European countries, have a fuck ton of space.
SUVs,
and it's just
are
part of our
on
culture.
A huge uptick in the rest of the world as well. Like, they're all over in Europe. They used to hate them, but now they love them.
I was just in England, and I was shocked.
But you're right.
I hadn't been there in about, 2 years, and the number of crossovers.
X5s and stuff. You see lots of them. Yeah.
Dude, it was weird. I was like, fuck, this is happening in England. It's weird.
Well, if you're the first person buy an SUV, you can see over all the other cars.
Yeah.
And then when the second person parks in front of you at a light, you're like,
fuck. I need a taller SUV. Never-ending saga of the height of the SUV.
Let's see. Yard Barber Lawn Care. I'll plug your business. Yard Barber. I went with a Fiesta ST to a Camaro Z28. All right. Well, there's a move. Mm-hmm. Passed on a Focus RS because of markup, and I'm now back in a Fiesta ST. Loved it the first time, but it seems sloppy after the Z. You mean after the race car you've been driving? Is it worth modding the Fiesta or swapping to an RS or other? What do you say to people
who have this? You know, so
you're beyond help, sir.
I had a horse, then I bought a car, and I went back to a horse. So how can I make my horse feel like a car? You know, it's like,
That's the question. How do I make my horse feel like a car?
Yeah, it's a little bit of tricky. I think actually what you should do is learn to revel in the awesomeness of the ST. It is there. It has a very different feel than the Camaro, which is the button-down, not really a playful car, not on a road.
No.
On a racetrack, yes.
Yeah.
But an ST is a really fun car to drive on a back road or, you know, without having to go stupid fast.
Totally.
Embrace the body roll.
It's the old slow car fast, right?
Yeah.
Better than a fast car slow. And most people are ripping around and they got their M3 driving it at 3/10 on the road.
Right.
And you could be in an ST driving at 7/10 having a ball go the exact same speed.
Yeah. There are a few things you can do to a Fiesta to improve it. We did on ours, we did poly bushings but
I wouldn't do it because I would rather have all of that visceral connection of the slow car
fast. I was
going to
say it didn't work out. I was going to say it didn't, and none of it made the car better, actually.
Right.
It made it like creaky. It made, when you'd go over like articulations, it made it creaky, and I don't think it made it much
better.
That
might be your knee.
Very good. I wouldn't sell your Fiesta again. I would drive your Fiesta for a while. They're fun. As someone with an RS, I kind of wish I still had
become
a Fiesta.
Become a driving enthusiast. Then you'll enjoy those slow cars like a Miata or what have you. They can be really fun.
There you go.
If you revel in the driving and the connection with you to the car, to the tire, to the road.
So I wish Skippy still had the Miatas.
Yeah.
Because I was like, oh, I want to learn all the momentum game on these slower cars. But now everything
Go visit Jack
like,
and Charlie. You can drive a Skippy Miata all day.
Oh, that's true.
Everyone has one, evidently. Comes with a lot of tires.
That's amazing, man. Yeah. They paid $10,000 for the Miata with like 4,000 miles on it. Of course, they were like, autocross miles, but whatever.
Still, you change the bushings.
They changed the clutch, the shocks, and the brake pads, and they were good to go.
Yeah. It'll last forever.
Let's see. Someone says top. I think he wrote this wrong. I think he means top luxury 7-passenger SUV, not top 7 luxury. So best best big SUV, 7 passengers. What's good with a third row?
I'm going to be biased here.
Please.
Shameful plug, I do work for them. I would say the XC90.
Oh, Volvo? Volvo's pretty car. Good looking, great interior, very safe. I think they said no one's ever died in one.
Yeah,
is that true?
It's in certain markets because they don't release those statistics. But yeah, Volvos are interesting. I've learned this. So again, this is interesting. But truly the only car made that is designed to actually crash above 35 miles an hour. It's actually tested to do that. Everyone else just tests to the crash test, which end at that speed. Volvo has this crash investigation team they've had for over 40 years. They actually visit real crashes every day. They build their cars for those crashes.
Hmm.
Only car manufacturer that does it. And they've always done it. And so now I'm like, if you care about who's buying the car, tell them to buy a Volvo.
That's a good one. That's a good tip. I always want to like Volvos. Always. And then their cars dynamically let me down every time.
A Polestar.
My girlfriend has
car.
One.
What year?
2015.
And what's wrong with it?
A lot.
Like, talk to me.
I drove the one that has the big brakes and the Olins and
that's
all that
the one.
Shit.
Yeah.
That was $64,000.
Yes, that's the car I'm talking about.
Yeah. We have the V60 R design with the Polestar tune.
Oh, no, that's different. Yeah. I mean a Polestar engineered car.
She fucking works
car.
At Facebook. She's not a racing driver.
I don't
want
to hear excuses here, man.
All right. Well, I'll tell you about the Polestar car. The blue one. Remember the blue one?
Mm-hmm. Rebel
great
blue.
Suspension, great tires, great steering, great brakes. Right? Gearbox was a fucking disaster.
Not
that
in the new one.
That 6-speed automatic was
trash.
Oh,
they have an 8-speed now.
That's good.
And here's all you guys need to know. 362 horsepower, supercharged, turbocharged, 4-cylinder, right? So, okay. That's faster around the Nürburgring than an M3 or an M4.
I believe it.
With about 60 less horsepower. That's how well that car gets around track. I went and drove one. They said it's kind of more like an S4 competitor. I went to Sweden. And I pulled away in it, and I'm like, this is way more crazy and manic than I'd ever thought. And I sat down with the Cyan Racing
and
Engineers,
then
the Polestar guys.
Didn't they build 20 of them or something?
No, this is the normal one. Yeah, they did build the 500 horsepower one. They did that, like Leno has one or what have you. But the regular one you can buy, it's like a 17 or an 18, is a really quick car. That's the one that's really quick around the Nürburgring. 8-speed automatic, paddles.
I will try it again. My girl has had some real problems with her car. Electronics have been all over the map. The camera comes on and goes off.
That's
the
old Ford Volvo. Could be. It is. Yeah. It is. I mean, it's a different company now.
Could be.
$11 billion kind of fixes a lot.
I just rented an XC90 in Europe, and I fucking hated it.
Really?
Yep. Hated it. Hated how it drove.
Diesel.
Gas.
Obviously. Oh.
Gas.
Weird.
5-cylinder.
Oh.
The T5.
No, the T5 is not a 5-cylinder anymore.
Oh, what is it?
It's just a turbocharged 2-liter.
Okay, well, that's what it was. Okay.
I think it might have been Chris Chilton.
I loved sitting in it. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I loved sitting in it.
Yeah.
The radio was good. It was comfortable. It drove like garbage.
Huh.
Yeah. Steering was weird. Brakes were weird. Steered like crazy. Front-wheel drive only.
Oh, front-wheel drive.
It was a rental. It is what it is. But it wasn't a cheap rental.
Yeah.
Yep. Sorry, Chris Chilton
wrote this review about the XC40 or something, and he was just like, it's not dynamically good, but you shouldn't expect it to be. Of just like, he liked cruising it around. Like, take the car for what it is.
Yeah.
So if you're getting a 7-seat, and now we live in an age where you can get a 7-passenger SUV that is dynamically fun and exciting. Maybe if they're not going for that, now that I'm not trying to do PR spin, it's just if they're just trying to make it comfortable and safe and all these different packaging things, like, are any of our customers really driving this quickly on like a back road? Not really.
Yeah.
So
I tested the XC40 against an X1, the Q3, and the Mercedes GLA 250. It was faster around the racetrack than all of them.
All of those cars are so
they're horrible.
They're all so
that's
terrible.
That's what I'm saying.
Sounding.
It was faster like by orders of magnitude. Yeah. And it was like 0 to 60 was quicker. Everything was quicker. And you know,
I will give
like,
Volvo. I'm a Volvo fan in theory. The same way I'm an Aston Martin fan in theory. And I want to like them. And both companies continue to let me down.
Go drive a 17, 18 engineered Polestar.
I will. I absolutely will. I would love to.
Yeah.
If you're out there, Polestar guy,
it has a hidden Sport Plus mode that you have to look up on YouTube how to get into that mode, but it's nuts.
To look up on YouTube how to get into
you
mode.
You will.
Tell us.
Jesus.
Tell us off microphone.
If I could, I would.
The gentleman. Nevertheless, I still am going to go with the XC90 for his question because I think in,
as a practical car.
Yeah. Yep. How long do I wait for traffic to pass while shooting one takes? If I have to wait like 2 or 3 minutes, just. I don't pass on double yellows in videos. I wait for traffic.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Responsibility. Fuel Aaron, equal money, the brand new C63S coupe or a 2014, that's a 991, 911 4S cab or coupe. You got two cars. Ooh. They're not really comparable here. Coming out of a Panamera Turbo and an old 63. Okay. Hmm. So,
I really like the C63. I mean, I drove the sedan a couple years ago, and I think the new ones look really good. But I don't like Porsche 911 Cabriolets. So
I don't. Yeah, I don't know about the cab. 911 and a C63 are like, all right, the C63 is like you have a C class, and then it's like steroid it up to the C63, right? So you have to make everything stiffer, make everything wider, make everything harsher with the 911. Everything is very soft and nice and easy, and it won't beat you up because the geometries are there.
True. And where are you driving? What are your road surfaces like? And if you liked your Panamera, getting the 911 will obviously be incredibly familiar.
Similar. Yes.
I would definitely go 911. Yeah.
Maybe not the four. Maybe skip.
I'm okay with cabs. I always hear people like all the time. I love convertibles as road cars.
Yeah.
It's like everyone wants to be like the track day. You know, whatever want to be, and they're like, oh, you get torsional rigidity, all that. It's like, it's a road car. Mm-hmm. If it's a track day car, yes, I'll cage it, you know, or do whatever I
should
do.
I just don't like cabs. I don't like them aesthetically, and I don't like the wind noise, so that's why.
I love driving them. You're getting a good one, though.
I like a Targa roof.
I have a box duress, like a simple car. I was just in it with my wife. We're up in the mountains looking at moose up in Colorado, and we have amazing drives in that car. I adore spending time in that car with my wife. It's so nice, and it's so quiet. At 100 miles an hour, we can talk to each other.
Porsches are very good at slipping through the air. Even my 87 is real quiet.
Then they get noisy because of that. The cabin's too long.
Huge gap.
But you have that wind deflector right behind you in a Boxster, you know, or a two-seater convertible. It's got such a great bubble, and stereo sounds good in that car. Everything works.
Nice. David says he bought your book after Tanner mentioned it back on this show in June, which he did.
Cool.
Thank you, David. Okay.
He wrote the foreword in the book, Tanner.
Yeah. Oh, he did? Great.
Yeah.
Someone has an FRS and goes on frequent 10-hour road trips with a girlfriend and a Greyhound. Whoa. Jesus.
Trying to get to 60 miles an hour.
Yeah. Under 20,000 bucks, what sedan or hatch handles the most similar to the FRS? So he's got 20K for a road trip car with more room than an FRS, but he wants FRS-like handling.
I would do a used BMW.
Yeah, E46.
Yeah,
20K gets you the nicest E46 on absolutely. The planet.
And that's
could do a 335. They're like 15 grand
or
with
a
manual.
135.
Make sure it has the sport package though.
Yeah,
335 sport.
The regular one is
true
a mess.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, 335 with a sport package.
Or I would.
I think a GTI. If you have a Greyhound, like
is that big? You know, Greyhounds are kind of big, right?
Yeah, they're tall. They're thin, but they're tall. They're like. I don't know. They're like a coffee table book. You stand on its side, it's tall. You lay down, it's very thin.
Oh, the Greyhound part, messed me up. So are there any wagons he could get? A wagon is a great choice.
Yeah, it's under 20K. Handling similar
to an
FRS.
Is there a 535 wagon?
E46 had a 3 Series
E46
wagon.
E46 had a 330 wagon.
Yeah, that'd be kind of fun.
That'd be a good
under
car.
Under 20?
Mm-hmm. That'd be way under 20,
should be,
probably.
Yeah.
Handling, you got to start with rear drive, right?
Yeah.
So it really eliminates a lot.
Yeah.
BMWs is really where you're at. Yeah. Yep. Thanks, Dan.
Kind of it, yeah.
Let's see. Tommy says, I daily an HPD my M17 manual M3 competition. Should I save money for a dedicated track car, such as an E46 M3, or should I not worry about wear and tear on my F80? I struggle with this thought every day and plan to sell the car in 4 years. What do you think?
Well, I don't know. Does he own it as an investment or just something to enjoy?
I hope not. It's brand new.
Yeah. So drive the heck out of it.
I say drive the new car. Yeah. Honestly, because here's the thing. You buy an E46, buy and build an E46 M3 track car. Now get it to the track. Now all this stuff.
Yeah.
That is going to be more than the depreciation on your M3.
Yep.
If you want to build a race car, build a race car.
Yeah.
But I think as long as you don't plan on crashing into walls, you can track your daily. Right?
Yeah.
Maybe a separate set of wheels. Maybe,
yep.
If you care.
Have a bushing budget.
opinion on the manual Aston Martin DBS Volante reliability and costs.
Get the extended warranty.
Yeah, definitely. So here's the thing with Aston Martins. The engines and stuff are tough. The gearbox and DBS is a Tremec. It is fine.
Yep.
The engine is stout. Big ticket items are relatively durable. I have an old Vanquish.
Yeah.
And but
mufflers.
But there's some little shit that will cost a crazy amount of money. So I would say the first thing you want to do is find an independent shop that will buy the Bosch versions of the parts and not the Aston Martin versions of the parts.
Yes.
You have just saved 80% on your repair costs.
It's like that with Ducatis as well.
Really?
A lot of the parts are also BMW parts you can get.
Really?
bits and pieces, like the sensors and things, and they're pennies on the dollar.
That's so funny.
So that exists throughout the industry. Ferraris too.
Ferraris, you know? Absolutely. Yeah. Use Magneti, Morelli, and Bosch and whatever.
That's where the your key phrase, a good local mechanic. They're the guys that know those little tricks.
Yeah.
Same part, completely different price.
Totally. Like the example I use all the time is the fuel pump on the Vanquish I have, which they wanted $2,700 for it, the Aston dealer. It's the same Bosch fuel pump that's used in the Ford F-250 with the 6.2 liter engine. So you buy the
amazing.
Ford, you buy the Ford part, it's the same. It's the same, and it's $179.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that is the kind of shit you have to do if
you
want to
own. How many did you buy and you're selling them on the Aston Martin forums for
$2,000?
Just get some green paint.
Yeah, exactly.
Just get the boxes. Just go to the dealer and dig the boxes out of the trash.
Have them printed.
You know, they're pretty stout cars, but when little things go wrong, they can be very, very expensive, so buyer beware.
Lovely to drive, though.
Very nice. DBS is really good car, especially the stick. Ed wants to know, should I get a 9th-gen Civic Si? Is that the new one? I don't know the gens.
Yeah.
Or a Mark 7 GTI manual. My budget is $20,000. Can you get into a GTI or a Civic for $20,000?
Yeah, the Civic Si I drove was 21 or something. I mean, you're going to be over it a little bit, but yeah, that's about how much it was.
Civic or GTI, what do you think?
I mean, I like the GTI better.
Me too.
I like the build quality. I like the looks better. I haven't driven doing it, but I'll trust you on
the GTI.
You know. Yeah.
5-door if you can afford it. If not, the Civic has a big back seat and a big trunk.
Civic Si, it feels like an older Accord. I mean, it's got plenty of space. It's going to last a long time. Like, you get a lot of nice things. I think you had like heated seats for $20,000. It came with a lot of shit for not a lot of money, but I don't like the looks of it that much, and that's a big deal for me.
Are you in a rush, by the way? Do you have to get
going?
Okay,
no.
Cool. So we'll get through these then.
All night long.
All right, great.
All night long.
Miles wants to know, what is a good autocross or track day car for under $12,000, presumably used, that fits someone 6'5"?
Miata.
Tall, old, used track
day car.
I guess
I can't answer that one.
No, Paul's out on this
<I'm> out.
One. For me, Mustangs and Corvettes tend to be pretty good.
Mustangs, though, what did we drive where the seats were, the headrest you had to like take off to and use it with the helmet because it pushed your head forward?
Oh, that
was the newer one.
Yeah, it was a newer one. You have to just pull the headrest off because it made your head go in a weird place. But
What about Miatas for you?
No.
No?
No.
Because Thad fit in my Miata because I think of the leg-torso ratio. I don't know which one of you is more leg or what.
6'5" is really pushing Miatas.
Okay.
I would just say no. You know what might work? A fucking Fit. A prepped Fit could be real fast. Where did that come from? Because one smoked us in AER last week. A K24 swapped Fit, properly set up, was so fast.
That's funny.
That's really
I
funny.
I bet you could get a K24 swapped Fit for like 15 grand.
Would he sit in the back seat or the front?
You'd move it. You'd sit like halfway to the back. Yeah. For sure.
Like a touring car.
You could fit a Mini, but it'll probably break.
Yeah, you could. That's true.
For 12 grand, like,
A $12,000 Mini, that's you're really rolling the dice.
Yeah.
But you could fit. Tall, good tall guy car. Yeah.
Buy one for $8,000 and have $4,000 in case.
Thank you, sir. Zach wants to know, what are your thoughts on the feeling of kart racing versus traditional racing? So, Paul, what can translate from karting and what doesn't translate to from karting?
Really, everything translates from karting except for the understanding of an aerodynamic car. So it's almost perfect, and it's scaled down, so it still can be expensive, but it doesn't have to be. Like, there's usually a good class that's, and this is outdoor karting, by the way, not, you know, indoor karting, which is fun, and you can learn from that too. But outdoor karting, and you go find, I always tell people, go to your local kart track, find out where it is,
find out what the most popular fixed cost class is. Like it's a Rotex class or whatever it happens to be. And race in that class. It'll have like maybe 50 or 60 people in it every race weekend. And you will learn more doing that per dollar than 10,000 times the amount of money spent on track days.
What's a good used cart going for these days?
$1,500 to $4,000, $5,000. And then these spec classes will have a hard tire that everyone has to run that lasts a whole weekend.
Oh, good.
You know, and then the engine isn't some open, you know, category where you have to run an engine that's going to blow up once or twice. If you go to like a real, like the Supernats or something like that, and you go into where they're the shifter cart guys, like when Michael Schumacher used to come over and race in Vegas at Supernats, and you had all the IndyCar drivers and F1 drivers coming over there. You'd go into one of those paddocks, and no joke, they would have 30 or 40 engines lined up for the weekend.
Because it's like three bolts, exaggerating. You just pull it off and throw in the garbage.
But that's how disposable those engines were. And they would also only use chassis for maybe one day or maybe one weekend, and they'd throw it away. Because the chassis is a suspension.
Yeah.
Right.
But if you go into these fixed classes and these spec classes, it's amazingly economical. And of course, you can fit the thing in the back of a 5 Series wagon.
Yeah.
Right? You don't even need a big custom trailer.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't need any of that. And your tires are tiny, so the cost of that versus car tires, your brake pads, your consumables. Right, all your consumables are so much cheaper, and the racing is ferocious. And people are like, I want to be a racing driver. How'd you do it? And it's I don't have any money. It's
karting.
Like, I didn't either. You know, you have to go and race karts. You have to do that. That's the economical way to go up the ladder. And if you can win in that class,
can you be too old though?
No.
You're in your 20s and you start racing karts. Your 30s.
No, is that bad? No. It's cool actually. Go race with the kids. No, you're not going to race 10-year-olds, but you're going to race 18-year-olds.
Yeah.
And if you can cut it there, you can cut it anywhere.
Mm.
You really can. So I think that the whole track day thing, while it's got a lot of people on the track, it's gotten people on the track more as car enthusiasts and not driving enthusiasts. Mm. It's not the right ratio. It's not these... And this is interesting, too. I learned this recently, or maybe I had an epiphany or whatever it was, But, you know, motorcycle track days are different. I don't know if you guys have ever done any or ride bikes.
I have not.
Those guys are all about learning how to ride.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they do schools and pro schools and Keith Code and Pridmore and all these schools, Kegwin, all these schools that travel around. It's a big part of the track day mentality of motorcycle enthusiasts. You go to professional schools. You get professional instruction. You learn the fundamentals. You learn the basics. You go to a track day that's cars, and those guys are just all about fixing up their cars and making their cars faster. And I think it's the relative safety of taking a car around the track. You just can't hurt really. Mm-hmm. And the motorcycle, it's, you know, a broken ankle, a broken collarbone is
always... All you have to do is see someone sail off a bike to go, I should be better at this before I even try this.
Right. But that mentality, if you had that mentality at a car track day, you'd be a rock star at a car track day. It's just they don't think they need it.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
And everyone doesn't think they need it. The bar is set so low. And everyone is you know, kind of achieving that same level. And that's why you don't see a lot of guys progress out of there. They plateau and they don't get better. And that kind of drives me crazy, because the traditional route of karting and then going to Skip Barber or Jim Russell, that produced racing drivers, you know, and really that's cheaper than doing track days. And it could turn you into, you know, it's the driver mod, and you get to take that from car to car. We all know that we've seen the T-shirts. We probably own them.
Yeah.
You know, but the point is no one does it. You know, they just spend more money on their cars. And if they want to go faster, they buy a faster car.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'll say that, like, I fell in love with cars before I fell in love with driving. And the first kart I ever drove, which was very infrequent as a kid, I was like 12.
Yeah.
But I've been going to car shows since I was 5.
Cool.
And I liked hearing them and seeing them. And all I wanted to do was be the person cruising and driving in the car.
Right.
So I think that's where a lot of people naturally go. They go, I want to get this car. I save up the money. I can get it. Now I want to drive it on the track. It's a focus on the car much more than the driving for most people.
Car enthusiasts.
At first.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, you come around and go the other, and then you go the other way
Sure.
You know, cars first, then driving.
And that's okay. I don't have an issue with that, you know, and I don't have an issue with car enthusiasts. I think that's great. But
It's when they're bellyaching or moaning about the driving or I need tire. It's the excuse making of, you know, and it's like, you could just go to a, hey, here's an idea. Go to Skip Barber.
Oh, I totally agree.
You know, it's like, yeah, fix the issue. But they don't do that. They'll bellyache for years with their buddies, you know, about how, you know, oh, you got a better car. You buy the better tires. I have to run the tires longer. I don't have the budget you have.
I need titanium lug nuts.
And meanwhile,
you know,
they're spending
weight.
More money doing that, complaining, than it would cost them to go to a real school. You have 3 days. You can up your level of driving if you've never done one, 100%.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, you'll get that much better. You'll lop 3 or 4 seconds, still have 5 or 6 to go, but you'll lop 3 or 4 seconds off of your deficit to what your car could do in one school. That's the cheapest improvement in lap time you would ever get.
So I shouldn't buy the lithium battery for $2,200? You guys aren't about that?
Yeah, the lightweight battery.
Absolutely. I mean, there's nothing too far-fetched anymore, is there? You know, just cubic money and throw it at the car.
Nicholas says, thoughts on the HSV Malou GTSR. Is that a ute?
Yes.
Like a big supercharged ute?
It's a ute.
It's a ute they don't make anymore.
All right.
I have no thoughts. I've never driven
one.
So
I'm kind of coming around. I think El Caminos and those things, I thought they were stupid. I didn't think they looked very good. But now, per our conversation of...
Going to put a cart in the back.
Well, yeah, that too. But like SUVs have so much drag, and it's like if you need to carry, you know, pickup truck stuff, but you don't need to be 8 feet in the air, like it kind of makes sense. Now, I do think that the false idea of, oh, I live in Australia, I need to go really fast and carry these pool supplies from one job to the other is like kind of false because their speed limits are so crazy. So, but it's fun. I'm sure it's fun.
Yeah. I don't know how much, what the weight distribution is. That's the stuff that always worries me.
Probably a little wonky.
Yeah. Interesting. Once they get kind of nose heavy, then it's just good for doing burnouts and drifting.
Right.
Right.
So, Australia?
Yeah. That shit's fun.
Yeah.
That shit's fun.
I mean, I'm sorry they don't make it anymore. That's a shame. I bet it's neat.
Yeah.
MB is French. He says a Gran Turismo belt broke overheat. The Maserati Gran Turismo, his belt broke and his car overheated 3 days out of warranty. Dealer didn't replace it during the service and charged afterwards. I hope he didn't pay you. Got CPO warranty upgrade to 18. Are you talking about selling your shitty broken Maserati and
getting
another Maserati?
Yes. No.
Don't
buy Maseratis.
The definition of crazy right there, right?
Somebody should put a billboard. Maserati, just don't.
I think that is there. It is not their slogan. I think I've seen that on Sunset or something.
I have no advice for someone.
If it's got a warranty and you're driving it within that warranty period, then I don't, you know, okay. Then maybe it sits in the shop a lot, but at least there's no out-of-pocket risk. But don't own that thing one day after the warranty.
Yeah, and don't go buy another one.
No.
They don't learn lessons in Italy. They don't fix things.
No. They eat pasta and drink wine.
They're so happy. Yes. And I think Maserati, you know, 5 years ago, the V8s were great and the cars were shapely. And now I don't know what's happening.
It's getting a little bulbous.
It's bulbous.
The
V6s don't sound good. Like, why would you down that path?
The Chrysler interiors. Yeah, the Chrysler interiors are no bueno.
I like Uconnect as a system, but, you know, if that's your interior design, if it's like, hey, this Jeep looks like my Maserati, like,
that's a problem. Wins.
Yeah, I don't mind the software aspect of it. That works, but like...
Buy a Trackhawk.
Right, for the same money. Let's see. All right, this dude, here's one. This dude wants to open an adventure company that offers drives from UK to India. What would
Is
you
his name
recommend?
Hannibal?
I mean, this can't be real. What would you recommend looking for a good value and reliable car for under 30K? So if this person is serious, he's trying to open a multi-country advent. Here's what you do.
You need more money.
What's the adventure, though? What is the actual adventure?
You fucking make it? I mean,
yeah, well,
know.
Then you need an unreliable. You need Maseratis.
Yeah.
See my point?
Hey,
if you have a reliable car, where's adventure? It's just
MB
a boring,
is Frenchie. Sell your car to this guy.
under 30.
I mean, Land Cruisers. Land Cruisers is what you want. Yeah. Toyotas.
Something like that.
Especially over there. That's what you want for UK, Middle East, and Africa. They've all bought those, and then you go to India, I guess.
You want Toyota Land Cruisers.
Series 1 Land Rovers.
Yeah, or Land Rovers.
What's that, Mahindra? There's a Mahindra SUV that they use for adventure companies in India. If you're driving there, maybe if it breaks,
maybe they have some kind of exchange program.
Right.
depends whether you're near England or near India when it breaks down.
I just hope that this person understands the capital involved and that his whole budget isn't just to buy this car.
At least he's not going to Beijing. He's stopping in India.
I mean, it's a cool idea. Like
restraint.
If you're doing, assuming you're going to be off-road driving, you probably want something that's not huge. Because a lot of the streets and everything aren't huge and big things weigh more. You need something with clearance, and you need something that has parts available in as many countries as you're going to cross as possible.
Yeah.
And support. Yep. Those will be simple, that's the criteria.
A simple vehicle.
Need.
Yeah. Go simple.
And last one, we're going to end the show on this. Paul, you recently drove an open flash BMW M. What is the deal with it?
What is an open flash BMW?
As opposed to a piggyback DCU?
Yeah, open flash. So I think you know this guy. Do you know Shiv Pathak of Vishnu?
I know. Yes. I've heard of Vishnu.
Okay, yes. So Shiv is open flash. He's a dear friend of mine, actually. He lives up in the Bay Area. And I go stay with him all the time.
They did a bunch of tuning on Evos in the early 2000s.
That's where I met him, because I drove an Evo in one lap for him. And I still have an Evo. I've had one since 2003. I love those cars. So anyway, he does tuning. And he does a really good job because he's a clever guy, really clever. And so he's one of the few guys. And Steve Dinan, actually, still, who I'm, as I described, and you know him really well. I've known Steve for years and years. Met him at One Lap, actually, a long time ago. And he's one of those guys, too, with chassis and engines where he can think, like, you know how they always tell you to make one change at a time on a car?
Mm-hmm.
Like when you're doing chassis setup? Steve doesn't have to do that.
He can do multiple?
Yeah, because he actually, in his head, and this is like how I try to train people to be as drivers, but he can picture all of it simultaneously. So if he's going to change one thing on the car, and, you know, as most people do, he's like, that's such a waste of time. He goes, I'll just do three things. I already know what that's going to do in every corner around the track and relative to what my driving skill set is and all that when he's my race engineer. And so Shiv's like that with engine tuning.
Okay.
He can do like all the parameters at once in his head. He's super, super clever like that.
Cool.
And so he does a very, very good job, you know, with his engine stuff. And he usually does it really fast because of that. So he's usually the first guy on the market to have a tuned car because it doesn't take him a year to tune a car. He does it in a weekend. I'm not exaggerating.
Well, wait, but the question, that sounds amazing, but the question is, it's a flashed car instead of a piggyback, which they've been using.
Yeah, yeah. So he
how come he was able to correct the flash?
Oh,
it is now.
Yeah, so you can get it. So he does have his own tablet. So to be honest, I don't really know the true answer other than he can tune those cars very readily. And I believe that the software has been cracked on them, on all those cars.
From the driver's seat, is there any difference with a piggyback tune and a flash tune? Shouldn't be, right?
Not technically, no. It depends on whether the resolution is the same and you can do the same things on the, with the piggyback.
Did everything else work in the car? Because now everything's so digital.
Yeah, like, and he even had it, you know, he was doing it all off his laptop because we were sitting in a parking lot like a Cold Stone at a mall. And he's like, now I'm going to put in the high torque map in the car. And then I went and drove it with the high torque map, you know, rather than he made a naturally aspirated feeling map that makes 100 and some more horsepower, but it feels like a naturally aspirated engine, even though it's a twin turbo V8. And then he did the normal tune, which is
just the huge torque shove at 2500.
And I said, you know what? On the street, I'll take the torque one.
Yeah.
On the track, I would definitely do the revy one because it was just more fun.
Yeah.
And the fact that you could switch between the two is really cool.
That's great.
Wow.
Well, I have my Cobb access port for the mount tune stuff.
Yeah.
So I'm able to load different. They email me the new tunes.
Yeah.
So they email me the tune and it goes in the access port, goes in the car, and then I can switch with the cruise control stock, which is fun.
Exactly.
So awesome.
Yeah. But the idea of flashing a BMW doesn't change how it drives. It just is an easier way to load.
Yeah, it is. And some cars you had to do piggybacks on because the code hadn't been cracked on the car.
Right.
And so what you're doing is called, it's an interceptor. So you're grabbing the signal and modifying it. And so, you know, and so you're able to do the same thing, but you don't have to crack the code to do it.
That is cool. The book is called Optimum Drive. Hold that up again for that camera, Paul. Paul Girard is the author, racing driver, instructor, badass in general, optimist. Thank you for coming by, man. I appreciate it. What else do you want to plug besides the book?
Well, really, that's it. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it. It's available as an audio book now as well.
Do you read it?
No.
Who read it?
The publisher did it. That's without
bullshit.
Even telling me.
That's bullshit.
I know. It's cool. The guy does a fairly good job. I like it.
This is kind of like the fucking Top Gear host going, you know, we like you, but in a helmet.
Exactly. And put the visor down and never raise it.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I got that a lot.
Paul, we like to see your name. We don't like to hear you.
Yeah. I get it. I used to write notes for all the cars because these would drive me crazy when they go review them. And I'm like, it's so wrong.
Oh, when they would talk about
it. So then I'd do notes and they did use them, which I was really thankful.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's good. Having input is good, not just being a guy in a mask.
Being the guy, yeah, that was tough.
Well, I got a flight coming up next week, so I'm going to take your book.
Okay.
And I'm going to read it. And in the meantime, the Smoking Tire Podcast is powered by Shout Engine. Get your own damn podcast at shoutengine.com. All you need is something to talk into, the internet, and something to say. Thank you all for watching live and participating with the Super Chat. If you are watching live, we will be back tomorrow at 5 p.m. Pacific with Ralph Guerra, who is a comic and a car writer and a good friend. Thanks for coming in, Paul. Good to see you.
Such a pleasure. Thanks for having me. It was so much fun.
Open Absolutely. Invite next you. Time you're in L.A.
Oh, cool. I really appreciate
I assume
that.
You, I assume you come through quite regularly.
I do.
As they do. And if you, social media is the Optimum Drive on everything, right?
Yeah.
The Optimum
the
Drive.
The Optimum Drive.
Instagram, Twitter, The yep. Optimum Drive.
Yep. Facebook.
All right. Get a hold of Paul if you want to hire him as a coach. That would make me very happy. Thanks, guys. I'll see you later. Bye.